Oh, welcome, my friends. Feels a little early, doesn't it? That old time change. I guess it's cliche to talk about it, but we're here. Sun is out. We're going to be talking about the sun quite a bit. How are you doing, Gabe? Welcome. Okay, we're still a little delayed. I think we can make it work, though. We'll just raise our hands at each other. You know, it might even fix itself sometime through there. Am I coming through okay to you?
It's a big delay, I think, but let's see how it smooths out.
I think it's going to be okay. I have a good feeling. So here we are. It's Marvelous Demystifiers all the way up to episode 28 of this, which is at this point like half Loki shows. And we're doing part two of season two, episode three. If you're just jumping in and you never watched the other ones or not all of them, don't worry. I'll make it make sense to you. We just like to use these shows as a teaching tool for the allegory of the universal wisdom tradition of the ancient philosophers. So because time is of the essence, I mean, time is the whole nature of the show. We'll just kind of jump right in and see where we left off. Let me get my screen share ready. And Gabe, you know, just raise your hand when you got to get in on it. And unless you've got something to say leading up, you know, before the recap, that'd be fine.
I got one thought is the 23, right? Season two, episode three. There's some DNA hail nod going on with the 23. It's always a DNA. And I remind people that it's also BC. BC is 23. So this, and we have a sacred text that is deciding the fate of the next generation, the next aeon to come. So yeah, there's some 23andMe DNA insemination of the new whatever, Bitcoin on the future.
I got to say hi to the chat real quick. I see Priscilla, Zerlath, Zenith, Aphelion, cool name, and PK. Zenith says, a word I've been dying to tell you guys about was cannibal. It's like Cain and Abel. Yeah, yes, indeed. Indeed it is. That's a weird one. This is all such fun stuff. I've been getting into Dune, so like that's filling my mind. There's a lot of parallels here, but the books, I mean. Anyway, this is where we left off before. So we got through probably like chronologically speaking about one third of the content of the previous episode, but it was just jam packed. This is 1893, the Chicago World's Fair. And this episode left off where Victor Timely has presented his temporal loom to all the investors, the potential investors in his project. And so we got to, just before we get rolling, remind everybody some of the things that I considered to be important to look out for in this episode. And as I continued looking out for them, they made themselves very clear. First of all, we're going to, like always, talk about two particular major arcana cards as the main focus for the episode. The real big focus, though, is the sun card, because Victor Timely, he's quite clearly a Kronos figure. And it is my opinion, I think, that the system proves itself that Kronos is actually anciently the sun before it was applied as a name to the planet that we call Saturn. So the gematria is where the system proves itself. And this episode gave me a good opportunity to show some of how that works, even between languages, and why words change the way they do to match gematria values and meanings, even if letters change. Because sometimes between alphabets, letters have different numerical values, powers of notation, they call it. So with Kronos, the first big clue that Kronos is the sun is that the letter that's attributed to the sun card is Resh. And Resh is 200 as a value by itself. But if you spell it out, Resh Yad Shin, you get 510. 510, that actually happens to be the value of Kronos in Greek. So here's one of those examples of how words between languages, you can see that they mean the same thing to the priesthood. Kappa. Yeah. Okay. So we're gonna also be looking at 216 and 600. You know, there's also something to consider that the K in Kronos is 20, not 200. I'm looking at my math here. I'm like, that's not right. So 20 plus 100 plus 70 plus 50 plus 70 plus 200 is 510. Just so everybody doesn't get confused by that. I accidentally made the kappa in this slide 200, but it's actually 20. So the math checks out. It's like the kaf in Hebrew. But yeah, we're also going to be considering the number 216. We established the relationship of 216 in the previous episode where that number existed in between the numbers of the 2 years that the episode is set in. So that would have been 1868 and 1893. You multiply the digits out of those and then subtract the products and you get 216. We're also going to be considering 600 because that's a huge solar number. And we'll see all the 600 is another really big deal. I think it's, where did that come from? I think that's the products added together, actually. And 216 comes from the magic square of the sun and 1893 multiplied together. Yeah, that's how it is. 1893, 1 times 8 times 9 times 3 is 216. Yeah. And the value of the magic square of the sun, 6 times 6 times 6, that's a 216. So Zenith says, you guys changed my life. And it's like Zen and Ken. Very good. And yeah, and then the products added together gives us the 600. So those are important letters, numbers. Also, the meaning of resh is like ras. It means head or person or first. It's the highest. It's wisdom. It's the leader. It's the rabbi. It's the father. A lot of important meanings to resh, as well as the other card that we're looking at is hey. Doesn't have as much gematria mysticism going on because the number 5 is a little limiting, but it does show up, especially the concepts of the star card, like electricity and interconnection and technology, things like that. Very big part of illumination, the stars. You know, when you look at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, it was all lit up with the theoretically, allegedly new technology of light bulbs in a way that the stars were dimmed by the artificial stars of all the bulbs on all the buildings. So we'll be looking at that. And then the value of resh and hay put together is 205. So 205 is also relevant, in particular because resh plus hay is the sign for Aries in the Hebrew notation, or is a sign for Aries, meaning the lamb, you know, the springtime. And that's kind of where we left off in the previous episode, because we established how Victor Timely versus He Who Remains, the Kronos figure in his winter form, He Who Remains, and his springtime, you know, spring chicken brand new form as Victor Timely, they're like the two goats of the temple, the scapegoat for the Capricorn version, the winter version, winter solstice, and the victim. Because that's what victim means. It's the sacrificial offering. The first three letters of Victor Timely, of his two names, V-I-C and T-I-M, you get victim right there. It's too good. It's too good. So our heroes are starting off where we are at here, wanting to bring Victor Timely back to the TVA because, as I said, he's the Holocaust. He's the sacrificial victim. And that's also why the original He Who Remains is outside of the TVA, even though he runs it. He's at the end of time. He's like the outcast, right? And we should also add that Jonathan Majors, the guy who plays these two characters, he's been fully scapegoated. He's completely fired. He's no longer going to be Kang. Who knows what they're going to do with their interwoven Marvel mythos, but he's the real life scapegoat. Yeah.
Yeah. So I love what you've discovered out of the anagram of his name. It's victim later, because you take the first syllables, put them together, and then you put the second syllables, you put them together, and it's victim later. Now, this is where there is double implication, because at the end of this episode, we will see the carcass of this victim later on in the film. However, it becomes very transcendent because we happen to know about the actor who becomes a victim later in reality. And so the meta echoes in the layers of the babushka are really significant. So yeah, I'm glad you found the victim later. Yeah, because it does. It unpacks, and it probably will continue to. Like, what happens when that actor dies? Like, the nature of his death is probably already foreshadowed in this, in the series. We just haven't seen it yet because that headline has not been introduced to the zeitgeist yet. So, yeah, we're probably treading on a lot of foreshadowing for that guy's, you know, the actor's actual fate.
And the PK wants to know if we got any juicy deets on his firing. I mean, if you want to look into the Hollywood tabloids, I kind of just scanned them to see if it was a thing, but it has to do with being convicted of some kind of like assault or abuse charges to a lady. He seems like a a bit unhinged. It comes through in his performances. You know, it's like one of those things where I don't think he's acting. He might just be crazy, but you know, who knows? You can't trust any of these like Disney folks or actors. Although I kind of like Tom Hiddleston, the guy who plays Loki. He seems legit, but you never know. So in what follows next is after Victor's given his big. Oh, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention on the resh. I think it's a very significant aspect of this episode. Because the world's fairs are where people went to get inspiration. It's where they got their head filled up with ideas. And there's something about this resh. It's the rushing intake of breath. It's also the moment when Adam and Eve had the scales removed from their eyes. It's as though they had seen the heavens for the first time. And so there's a gasp. There's like a... that is the spirit filling you with ideas. And so the resh is so significant in the inspiration of the World's Fair. And it even has to do with the hot air balloons that they fill up with a negative buoyant energy that allows them to fly at all. So the resh of inspiration is also what happens to the hot air balloons. So I just wanted to put the hot air balloons back on the map. If anybody forgot from the last time, that's very significant.
What you say is really pertinent indeed, because you can look at resh as being related to the idea of the ruach. You know, it's a very close word. S sounds or SH sounds can easily philologically change to a ach or a k sound. So resh and ruach. Definitely related. Ruach is the spirit. So in terms of the interesting dual nature of putting the sun and the star card as the things we're analyzing most closely in this episode, it's like the resh is the gasp, you know, the inhalation of in wonder. And then the hey is like the whoa, hey, you know, the exhale of when you're in awe. So you're absolutely right about that. 100% right. And there's other ruach like things that will come through.
It's almost like we're disambiguating the Owen Wilson's wow. We're actually embodying the wow on this episode.
The wow factor. This one will give you some wow, I think. So he's given his big presentation about his temporal loom and his free energy time manipulation device, and the crowd of interested parties, including Renslayer, competes for his attention, and we're then told that his device is a prototype. He's talking to a robber baron. That's a very, like, historical archetype as well. In fact, like you said, with filling people's heads, their resh, with wisdom or information, in the World's Fair, that seems to be the whole purpose of the World's Fair, was to create the narrative of history of America and what other places and peoples were like. I'm not saying there was like a complete societal reset But if there was, the World's Fair totally fits as a thing that you would do to set the stage again, to like reset the table with all the brand new humans and what they're supposed to think about the universe. It totally would fit. So one of the things with the number 200 that the letter Resh represents, it's very, he's talking about his prototype, and a similar word to prototype would be archetype. And this is significant to our analysis as Victor Timely as the sun, because Adam, the archetypal man, or the whole body of the universe as the whole body of God, is called by more modern occultism, Adam Kadmon, which reveals the connection between Kronos, Adam, and the sun, with the value of 200 or the letter Resh and Adonis, because Kadmon equals 200. The name the Greeks gave to the Phoenician, the mythical Phoenician that gave them the alphabet, was Kadmus, in Hebrew, QDM, same first three letters as Kadmon. The giver of letters is the Logos, of course. You know, that's always an often an attribute to the gods of eloquence, the Hermes, the Mercury, Odin getting the runes, you know, even Ad in Adam, Od in Odin. You know, Adam is also Adonai. Or the ancient author Stephanus says that Kronos was called Adonos in Greek. So there's your Odin, Adon, Adonos. And the Latin would terminate with M, so Adonos becomes Adam. So Kronos is Adam. And he further says that this Adonis, is A-D-A-N-U-S, but it's exactly the same as the Phoenician Adonis, that he was the son of heaven and earth. So now contemplate the Hebrew Old Testament using the word Adonai to refer to God, where in the English translations, they simply put God or Lord as the word. The archetypal man is the first image or body, the prototype. And so now you understand the mystery that Kadmon would be an epithet of God, and it is in Hebrew. My interpretation of all this is that the original system, possible or a branch of it, held that the entire cosmos was Adam, the firstborn son of God, or that the sun is Adam, the S-U-N of God, S-O-N of God, or mystically both, because the union of heaven and earth describes our life in between both. And another interesting bit of math to consider, back to prototype, is the Hebrew word for prototype, it equals 168, which is the value of 24 times 7. That would mean 168 hours are in a week. So the week is like the prototype of cycles. You know what I mean? It's an archetypal man, Kronos, Adam, is the prototype, of course. So if you add hey, meaning the, to Kadmon, it becomes 205, the archetypal man. We'll see more of the 205 later in the episode. So there's a lot to that. And we'll just look at this Etruscan ash box right here. This is an Etruscan artifact depicting the Battle of Cadmus with the dragon from the second century BC. Now, Cadmus is the mythical founder of Thebes and also, like I said, the giver of letters. But here he's shown in the Etruscan ash box defeating a dragon, very much like St. George or Archangel Michael, other typically solar archetypes that are the dragon slayers in myth, which lots of reasons for that. And remember that Cadmus is the founder of Thebes, because we're going to get into the phonetics of Thebes later in the episode too. But this is a really cool artifact. So next we see Timely talking to his robber baron, who says, no, I was thinking along the lines of a partnership. And he says, nope, I don't do partners. Well, that's perfect for the analysis of Timely as the sun. He doesn't do partners because he is soul, S-O-L, soulless, the alone one. Yeah, makes sense. This moment, though, he starts taking bids. And I just thought it was a little strange because here he is as he's a black man getting bid on by wealthy whites. I don't know if we're supposed to think something of that, but it seems like he's enjoying it. Seems right. Like it's going well for him.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. There's definitely a bit of a vanity aspect of it. That's very interesting.
Now, this one of the bidders, the robber baron, he's like pushing aside the plant who was in the crowd. Timely had a plant in the crowd, and he used to call him a hornswoggler, which is kind of fun because, first of all, hornswoggler is a term to indicate trickery or deceit, but a horn is the QRN. That's the root of Kronos. We'll see more of that later. Then we have, this is fun. Loki ends up stepping on the foot of this big brutish man. The stepping on his foot is equal to saying his shoe was stepped on, but the shoe has the same value, 200, as Resh. The word is like nolim. It's something like that in Hebrew. The pronunciation is always tricky, but it's same as the sun or Resh, the head. So, you know, your foot and your head connect to each other. That's the archetypal man. That's the zodiac man, Pisces to Aries. But also the shoe is, along with the sun, it is a symbol of the motive power, or that which causes motion, because the shoe represents the ability of movement. I also wanted to add that in the Heliopolitan cosmology in Egypt, atom, which is the same word as atom, atom or atum, the creator, created the Ennead, or the nine divines, including the sky goddess Nut and the earth god Geb, because Geb and Nut were locked together in intercourse. Nothing could exist upon the earth because there was no space between the earth and the sky. So Shu is the god that separated Nut from Geb, allowing manifest reality to emerge through duality. The Greeks associated Shu with Atlas, whose name is basically Addis, which is the same as Adam. Oddly, it's our shoes that separate us from the earth as well. You know, like our physical shoes. So here's a old piece of sculpture that basically shows Shu in a similar posture to Atlas. Fun times there. Now we see the trickster Timely and the plant he had in the crowd. It was his own controlled opposition, who he had prepared with a tough question or a bid that Timely secretly had planted so that he could seem genuine and respond to the logical criticisms. I forgot what this is called in rhetoric, though. It's like a Greek tactic where you plant somebody in the crowd. I think Gabe will know what that's called. But it's interesting because he conceals the money that he was given by the bidder in this guy's hat, which is like another reference to the Resh, or the head, since that's where you put hats. He wisely puts it in the Resh.
Totally. Yeah, you're right. I think it is a plant when you put somebody in the crowd to say something that you anticipate that actually plays into your agenda and makes you, you know, look like you're Mr. On the Ball. There is a great amount of like insider trading language going on in this scene, because you mentioned the bids. And I think it was Seven Bomar who mentioned how we have Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin. And so the two power players on the global stage are Poots and Bids, which is the stock market nod, right? The puts versus the bids. And then sure enough, they go from, I think the first bid was 500, and then the final bid was 1,000. So there's a 5 and a 1, going back to our 5 and our 1 earlier. And I think it's also, there's tipping of hats. There's a lot of tipping of the hat going on here, which is table talk, right? Tipping your hat is actually inside. Only those who know speak the sign language of tipping the hat. And in fact, in some old Western communities, if your elder crosses your path, you're supposed to remove your hat all the way and give some honor to the veterans who gave you this land under your feet, who came before you. So that, and also when a lady walks in the room, you all stand up and offer your chair and take off your hat and, you know, show some damn manners, you friggin' heathens. So, yeah, all of the hat etiquette is really pronounced. Because Abraham Lincoln the giant Abraham who gets disappeared, he literally flips Loki's hat off. Chance, have you ever had somebody knock your hat off in disrespect? Has that ever happened to you? Like real legitimate disrespect?
I don't remember. Nothing that sticks out, but maybe it's happened. You want me to pull up your image, Gabe?
Go ahead. It's worse. Yes, yes, yes. So when somebody knocks your hat off in disrespect, it is worse than being punched in the face because it wasn't anything significant. It was symbolic. And because it's symbolic, because it's artistic, it has a plausible deniability. So they're not knocking your hat off, but it is symbolic of taking your head off. It literally is like, I remove your head, but nothing really happened. This is just theatrics. And so the plausible deniability of theatrics is the pinnacle of subversiveness. And this is part of why I changed my channel from the Slick Dissident Shared Learning Experience. I've altered it to the Shared Artistic Expression because art has more subversive power. And that artistic subversive power, I think, is going to be one of our greatest weapons in our own arsenals. So, yeah, when he gets his hat knocked off, the hat doesn't come back. It's gone for the rest of the episode. That's actually an interesting symbolic nod. A tip of the hat is going on. And then sure enough, when Victor Timely goes and pays the guy, he pays him under the hat. So there's all this like gentlemanly, the word gentleman in Latin is caballero. The word gentleman in Latin literally means like cowboy. So yeah, there's a lot of cowboy talk in the signs and symbols of this room full of bids and puts in the market that's going on here.
Oh, you caballero, if you just do the BP switch, which would happen, you have a capa, it's your cap. Gentleman is the guy that wears the cap. Good stuff. Maybe the fact that this episode has to do with like the birth of the sun and Aries, that the hat not coming back is, you know, he got the clip. He got the old just was born.
Well, yeah, you know.
Clip the tip.
Yeah, totally. Yes. You know, in Aries is the Perseus constellation, and he's holding the Medusa's head and a purse, the red bloodied sack that he kept her head in. So yeah, the tipping of the head, the resh, the head of Medusa, is totally in Aries. That's very apropos.
Oh, and then yeah.
This guy, he gets disappeared. He gets disappeared and reappears in that pig's care, the pig's wagon that we saw earlier. There is a great deal going on with that. Whenever I see pigs symbolically involved in sacrifice, my mind goes directly to Spain and the mythological value of the fact that the Hebrew altar of Gibraltar is a point of contention. It's also that 37 degree Mason-Dixon line, which PK has pointed out, history has moved the Mason-Dixon line to 39. It depends on who you ask and when you ask. PK's right. It is actually recorded at 39. And here we are in 1893. The 9 and the 3 is very significant. But I just wanted to say the crossing of boundaries, this tipping of the hat was one transgression too much. But it's symbolic. It's not a real fight. And so the fact that he responded with theatrics might be telling us that most of war, most of all historical confrontation is theatrics. It's smoke and mirrors.
Well, it occurs to me now that the Greeks associated the god Ares, not exactly the same as the sign Ares, but there's connection with the boar. And in fact, that's how Adonis died. You know, Adonis was killed by a boar that some said was actually the god Ares transformed, and Ares is the god of war. So the pig is the domesticated boar. And not also, you know, you could even make a case that Resh and Aries are like an anagram for each other. If you pronounce the S like Greeks often do,
it would say like
Aries.
Nice. That's totally there.
Something else that's there. We have back to our 216 and our 600. First is we're seeing Renslayer here. These females, Miss Minutes and Renslayer, are like the oracles and the Yoni power. They know the secret of the Holy of Holies. And that's what this word, D-V-I-R in Hebrew, which I think is probably like diviner or connected to that root, Deva. That's a 216. It refers to the Yoni, the Holy of Holies, the female oracular power. But then there's this word, Mem, Yen, Nun, Kof, Tav. Yeah. Minquat. I don't know how they pronounce it, but it's a wet nurse, but it's also biblically or poetically the idea of the bowl for libations or the sprinkling vessel, like a baptism water vessel or a holy grail. So, you know, what do you do after the baby is born? In the zodiac, the baby being born is possibly, you know, you could consider the new year born at the spring equinox with Aries. You baptize the baby, right? And they're basically planning to anoint Victor Timely as their future Messiah. In a way, you could consider her like a wet nurse because she nourished him when he was a child with wisdom by providing Victor Timely with the TVA guidebook. There's also a correspondence with the hay or the star card, the number 5, as the idea of a door or a gate or a division, because there's one word, bet alpha, like BBA. It can have a meaning referring to in a time to come in the future, because the gate indicates a transition from one state to another. This is a mystical correlation between Resh and Hay 205, because Resh means wisdom, and words for a gate, which is what Hay can mean in Greek, is a pile, and in Indian or Hindi, it's pule, which are both phonetically a match to the pal, a palace, which is wisdom. So there's all this like all this phonetic linkages that connect these two concepts really closely, the gates and the wisdom, and the gate, and that is also in Aries, that the gate to wisdom is in the head. It's the third eye. That's the portal. That's the gate, the pile, the pule, all of the above. So we have the tipping of the hat, and Loki, after he gets his hat knocked off, he uses, which was not a wise decision, speaking of Resh, he does a wondrous deed and causes the guy to disappear in a cloud of fog and mist. So there's a phrase that means like astonishing, miraculous marvels and wondrous deeds. That's a 600. And then there's an obscurity or fog or mist phrase that is a 600. So that's kind of fun. You know, it's like the hidden miracle of the cycle of time. Definitely there.
Totally. You know, while we're talking about hats and tipping the hat and knocking hats off and making a show of things, I think the theme of the circus is really strong with this episode, because we're coming up on the Ferris wheel. So the circus is also intrinsic to the episode. But this, I see, having to do with the year that we're on right now, with the presidential onslaught on our horizon, the term for putting your name in the ring, that's the technical term for putting yourself out there as a presidential candidate. And now I want to compare Renslayer in this episode. I want to put her in the position of Michelle Obama. And the fact that she's about to approach Victor Timely and make her bid for this gentleman's situation. I'm going to evolve her for this episode into this star card, because the star card is very correspondent with Michelle Obama coming on the stage in a, for the sake of provocation. It doesn't matter if she's going to get it or not. It just matters if she pisses people off. And the fact that, you know, we're supposed to believe that Putin is so offended by transgender people that he might nuke us, and the chance of people being like, oh yeah, let's see you nuke us. Come drop your bombs, buddy. I think Michelle Obama being a trigger to try to pretend like Putin gives a shit about that symbol is very provocative. So I just want to put Renslayer in the context of Michelle Obama about to put her hat in the ring, so to say, in this exact moment. And that is she is a vessel. These cups are vessels of animosity and vitriol and all of your scariest RuPaul nightmare coming true.
Yeah, she is a scary nightmare. That's true. Michelle Obama. Yeah, I don't even want to comment on it other than the irony. There's irony there of threatening nuclear attack because of gays when nukes themselves are fake and gay. Huge irony. So here's the guy, though. He's in the big guys now. What's that?
That's the key ingredient is fake and gay. That's the key ingredient to all good triggers.
And the weaponized irony, you know, weapons are made of iron. It's not lost on me. That's how you say irony. So I don't even know if that they're claiming that, Gabe. I don't pay attention to what the theys talk about. I just read books and make podcasts. But the funny thing about this guy being in the cage that previously held pigs, and he's like aggressive, like a boar, you know, and he's a boar as in a ruffian, all of that, which is Aries symbolism. But the one of the Hebrew words that equals 200, like the resh, is livestock. So there you go. Livestock. Honestly, guys, I know you're going to see a lot of like Hebrew gematria in this episode. I pretty much was able to find somewhere or multiple places in the episode that correspond to like every probably 90% of the Hebrew words that have the values that I laid out. 200, 510, 205, 216, 5, 600. Those are the numbers. All pretty 90%, maybe more, of the words that I can look up that have that from ancient Hebrew, like biblical Hebrew, that have those values. They show up in this episode one or more times. So that's why I go nuts with it, because it's like, it's almost like that's the programming algorithm they use to write the script or something. I don't know how else to put it, or it's God speaking through letters and numbers, or some of both. So now, though, we move on to the drama of who gets to take Victor Timely with them. Is it going to be Loki and Mobius, or is it going to be Renslayer and Miss Minutes? And this competition ensues as he realizes that the competition for his attention is complicated because both parties already know each other. And then just to... remember in the previous slides a few back, I mentioned prototype, and I said that the word prototype in Hebrew is 168, and that's the number of hours in a week. And here in this scene, a guy walks up and he's like to Timely, I want my money back, Timely. These trousers don't work. I told you they were a prototype. Well, perhaps I can come by next week. Next week? Next week. Yes, fine. So there it is, like prototype and the week. Here it's mentioned the dupe is being placated by being told he'd be helped out in a week's time. So that I didn't even know the second occurrence of prototype was coming up. And I was like, ah, yes, I was right to think so, that we should be thinking about the week. Very good. Jolly good. And then we see Loki having the realization that Timely is a con man, a confidence trickster. And Timely puffs up his chest. Like literally grabs at his chest and he's like, luminary is the word you're looking for. A luminary, you say. What's the greatest luminary? Is it the solar luminary? And is confidence a solar plexus trait that he's puffing up right now with confidence and holding at his chest? I think so. I think so indeed. And they understand each other. He says, Timely says, or Loki says, I never doubted it for a second. And Timely says, enlightened fellows never do. So as fellow enlightened fellows, fellow lights, solar archetypes, they, of course, comprehend and understand each other perfectly. Now, this is about to get fun. This is a big, goofy chase scene through all of the, through a lot of parts of the 1893 World's Fair, which, by the way, they did a great job making sets for this show. Like, a lot of these sets were physically built in even, like, some of the alien worlds and stuff. There's a lot of creativity to that. It's part of what I like about the show. You feel like you're, it doesn't always feel just pure CG. You kind of feel like you're there. In fact, from what I can tell, this is the, you know, assuming that it's accurate, if it is accurate, is allegedly the most accurate portrayal of the Chicago World's Fair in film. So that's fun for people that find that to be one of the weirdest events of all human time.
Interesting. Yes. Well, you know, one thing that we've been picking up on through this process. Oh, thank you. Thank you. is that there's always an obligatory race scene, right? Season 2, episode 1 opened with the Messier marathons where Loki's being chased. And then the next episode was Loki chasing Brad. And now here we have Victor Timely being chased. So this this racing aspect is just strangely obligatory. But I just want to remind people about the 12-day around-the-clock manhunt for John Wilkes Booth. I think we're seeing echoes of that, of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln are being seeded yet again in the film, which is just fascinating because we know about the threads between Lincoln's assassination and JFK's assassination. And right now on the global stage, we have a JFK descendant. We have the JFK blood is being recirculated in our language, and JFK is embodied by the Sun card. And so to have the echoes of the Abraham Lincoln assassination rippling forward through the trauma cycles onto JFK and splashing into reality right now is very profound because JFK Jr., JR, is a 1-9. And this is his card, as far as I'm concerned. And JFK Jr., he echoes back to Walt Whitman and Thoreau. This is Whitman and Thoreau right here, basically. Thoreau was accused of being an anarchist, which has some RFK echoes, right? He's supposed to be the voice for whatever, the rebel forces. There are also echoes into Al Gore, who is Al Ghul. That is the demon star in the head, in the hands of Perseus. That is the Resh that he's holding, is Al Ghul, the demon star. But their common thread is environmentalism. Thoreau was a spokesperson, was a polyhymnia rhetorician for environmentalism. Al Gore, same mantle. And now RFK is holding the head of Medusa, and he's petrifying the world with climate change. So the consistency of the thread is complete. It is complete.
You brought up assassination. Did you know that the World's Fair in Chicago ended with the assassination of the Chicago mayor? Bum, bum, bum. Just let that hang. Wait, that's pretty good, isn't it?
Say it again. That cut out. Say it again. It cut out right when
The Chicago World's Fair in 1893 ended with the assassination of the Chicago mayor. Not to mention the World's Fair in the Pan American Exposition in 1901, the World's Fair in Buffalo, New York. William McKinley, the 25th president, was shot. I don't think he was killed, but an anarchist shot him. Even the 25 is important. The 25th president being, because 25 in the 25 in the I Ching can be interpreted as innocence or sacrifice. So the 25th president being assassinated or shot makes perfect sense. Wow.
That is amazing. Wow. I did not know any of that. What a heck of a thread. That is a power, power, power weave.
Well, I just love how you pick up on threads psychically. You know, you're like John Wilkes Booth. We're talking about, yeah, we're definitely, you're in the ethers or something. But I thought it was fun that he's hiding behind this pillar. Let's see where I'm at in my notes. So the robber baron comes out with his goons to try to catch con man Victor Timely. And we see this doorway behind him, which is a hay. And we see a lot of clear doorways and windows being used as doors. So that's part of where the hay of the star card comes in. And particularly because you see how it's illuminated with light bulbs that are like stars. So that is a thing. Now, he's hiding behind a pillar, wisely, palace. And a pillar is a pylon. So there's some phonetic connection there. There's this Egyptian theme here along with him. And he's hiding, which invokes the sense of Amun, the hidden one, or the sun at noon, where the shadows or the darkness is hidden. But we also have this word Atzmi, which is a 205. And I think I spelled it differently or transliterated it differently when it comes up later. But we see a lot of throngs or multitudes or crowds. But it's very much a hey idea or a star card type of idea, because another way to understand this word in Hebrew isn't so much that it's about, it's, it can be used in context as a crowd or a multitude of people or throng, but it also is like numbers and strength, like the strength of numbers, which is Aquarius is kind of like that. It's the strength of the whole made up by its parts. So those two things. And this is, I really like this slide. Oh, I wanted to say too about the multitude is the how the solar generative power in the spring equinox gives rise to the multitudes of life that spring up at the time of spring, which is why the word that refers to a big crowd like they we see here is equal to 205, which is the Aries signification. Resh hay, the Ferris wheel is like the ferry, the bearer, because that's what it means in Latin, ferry. The bearer, even think of like bear and fair, the F becomes a P or the P becomes a B. There's all this philological thing that makes you know that fairy and bearing are the same word, but it's the Ferris wheel is the carrier or bearer of Esh, fairy Esh. Esh is the fire solar symbol. And you have it totally grand, you know, lit up all the way up to the top. We'll talk more about the Ferris wheel later. But in this slide, oh, Gabe, you want to jump on?
I'll save it for the Ferris wheel weave.
Okay. So, first of all, there's a 216 here with the guy's raging, the robber baron. That's Resh, Vav, Gimel, Zion equals 216, means trembling with rage and anger. This guy is definitely like, you can see his mustache quivering. But what I picked up on here that kind of tripped me out is how Timely yells for assistance to a nearby vendor. We'll see in the following slide. And he yells, Hugo, just randomly. Like, this is not a character in the rest of the episode. So we got to think about the name Hugo. So I'm going to just start with the word in Greek, upsilon eta sigma, which you'd pronounce Hughes. This was placed on the temples of the sun or temples to Bacchus. It's the origin of the IHS that you see in Catholicism with Jesus. The latter, the IHS, being a corruption of upsilon eta sigma. The hue of upsilon eta sigma is the same root as in hudor, which is the Greek word where we get hydro or water. So it's an indication of the solar symbolism laid up in water and rivers, like Bach of Bacchus, meaning a stream in German. Hugo in German is a Germanic name that has an etymology that means mind or intellect. So there it is. The logos idea descended from the solar deity Hughes or Bacchus. The gematria value for Hughes, upsilon eta sigma, is 608, which is an updated version of the same idea of the Nero cycle of incarnating saviors, that the original system was altered from being 600 to 608. So we will look, you know, we'll think about 608 when we think about 600, because the Greeks basically updated it from 600 to 608 for what their priesthood thought was necessary to make all their historical revisions work out. But basically, pay attention, pay very special attention to words with the gematria value of 608 as they pertain to the system, because this Nero's cycle of reincarnating saviors, whether it's Cyrus or Pythagoras or et cetera, like, or Jesus or Mohammed, this is like the secret of secrets of the system, is this knowledge of the cycle. An example of another word that will show you this change from 600 to 608 would be the word fen, which would have potentially been spelled phi nun nun, which is 600. But then you add in the eta, which is the E in fen, and you have 608. This is actually the same in, let's see. Yeah. This is the root of the fen of the Phoenician or the Phoenix or the Irish calling themselves Fenians, or the word ben in Hebrew being son, as the P and B can interchange. Clearly, Victor Timely, he's a reincarnated he who remains. So he's a Phoenix allegory, a solar allegory, of course. To add to the symbolism here, though, the Egyptian themed background has, you can just barely see it, but there's palm trees here. So the palm tree was the bayan, which, or the ban, which is the same word as fen, P and B switch. It's also like ion, bayan, which is a name for time or chronos, with the B in front. So the BP swap, in effect, meaning the name bayan for palm, is the same as fee, nun, nun, the fin, the pin, the phone, etc. The palm tree is symbolic of this cycle of renewal of incarnations of the savior, because it possessed the faculty of renewing itself without the process of generation or fructification, like the serpent. Some palm trees last hundreds of years and they don't really change throughout the year like the seasonal climate trees do. So it's a lot like what why the Christmas tree is evergreen trees in more northern climates, because they're both trees that pretty much just stay the same. So they're thought to self-renew. They're thought to have that immortality. The ancients actually might have thought the palm tree was immortal, because the author of one of the Psalms in the Old Testament of the Bible talks about the righteous shall flourish like the palm tree. Even we'll see a similarity in the word psalm and palm. The Egyptians called the palm the bay or bay, and they gave the same name to the soul, ba or bay or bay. And we don't really know how Egyptians pronounce words. It's also said that the Holy of Holies in the Egyptian Hebrew tabernacle was surrounded by palm trees. You've got the Hebrew version of this is pe ayin nun hey, which is, or a Hebrew version of this, that's translated in the Bible about Joseph to be a word that means auger. So there's a connection to the auguries, because the whole prediction of the next coming of the cycle or the savior was one of the main reasons to have augers. Higgins thinks that this, Godfrey Higgins thinks that this Hebrew pe ayin nun hey is the same as, or it's definitely an anagram for the fin of the phoenix, like the Phoenicians. There's a quote I have here from Godfrey Higgins and Anacalypsis, where he says, "I apprehend the palm tree or the phoenix tree was the sacred tree, the tree of wisdom, for another reason, from the use of its leaves for the purpose of writing." Of course, you see here, this isn't the kind of palm tree that has those type of leaves, but some have big, broad leaves that you could use to write on. It had the name of the Daum tree, tree of the Aum or Om, dome. The phoenix was the Om, the cycle of 600. It was the ornament of the Holy of Holies of the Jewish temple of the Ion Tan Ayanan, the eternally renovating cycle, which was one of his names. In fact, in ancient Egypt, phena meant cyclus or periodus, so, or avum, which is like an age. So cycles and periods, repeating cycles. So that's what I have on this. I'm going to pass it over. Not all of that just because the dude yelled, Hugo! I was like, all right. And there's a palm tree. We got to talk about this stuff.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Something, there's a lot of things pinging for me as well. When I hear Hugo, many things. First of all, South Carolina, Hurricane Hugo was a historic catastrophe. It was actually a touchstone of the culture down there because it affected everybody. I happen to have lived in the wake of Hurricane Hugo in South Carolina. In the Carolinian state flags are central around the palm tree. And so to hear Hugo and see a palm tree and have lived in the Carolinas before, I also know that the 37-degree markation of Mason-Dixon, a crucial boundary, but also the Carolinian bloodlines are signified here powerfully. And then, Chance, can you pull up the – actually, can you pull up the Wikipedia link? Because I want people to look at this guy's face, like take a mental picture of this face, and then can you pull up Hugo de Groot in the Wikipedia link I telegram to you? Just pull up his picture because it's almost like the same guy. He just needs my beard. Like those eyes kind of match. Hugo de Groot is the Mozart of international law. And then, Chance, can you pull up the image that I sent you that is a Slick Dissident original? When I studied Hugo de Groot, I think that... Go ahead.
What if AI generated all of this Renaissance art and all this history is totally fake? His eyes are weird. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, we definitely know that the movie is generated. but this is kind of part of I Am Groot. I am Groot. This root stem, this rhizomatic root stalk of culture. This character is the bedrock of international law. And when you take on the identity, when you play games with the bullshit I fake it, you are in his domain. And he is the Mozart, again, with subversive art, using art to subjugate the people. So this is a collage from when I was researching him. But here we have Hugo. We have the palm tree. I'm saying that this guy, the spirit of Hugo de Groot, the Mozart of international law, I think he is the palm of the guarantor. He is the hand of the guarantor on the other side of private contract and international law. And so... This is a whole side dig, but when you said Hugo and you mentioned the palm tree, and we're talking about the contract and the exchange. Oh, you mentioned that the palm is also like a bond. It's also a bond, right? The paper that is a bond. Yes, it's like my word is my bond. Well, this piece of paper is now your bond. Now
the shake piece hands of paper to make is a deal with your palms touching.
You're bound by. Yeah. Right. Right. And then one more, just a side weave. Well, no, I'll just leave it at that. Yeah, this guy is going to be on my radar forever now because I think he is one of their secret patriarchs. We'll just say that. I think they have a secret patriarchy that so often in conspiracy culture, if you hear the name often or frequently or becomes commonplace, they're probably not really that meaningful. And every once in a while, you find a character who you're like, I've never heard of him. And he happens to be in a position to have influenced time and history from behind the scenes on the private side. So yeah, Hugo de Groot is totally on my radar big time because he's obscure.
That's always a clue. Okay. You'll love this one, man. I bet you didn't catch this because it's just barely visible in the background, but we're talking about the cycles, right? In this chase scene, an interesting segue, we see the volcano of Kilauea cyclorama. It's a whimsical chase scene, but chance. Just in the background. What the hell? The cyclorama was a 360-degree panorama of painting depicting the lava flows from this Hawaiian volcano and was a big attraction to World's Fair visitors. It was like, you know, it was like 19th century VR. And it's appropriate that we should get at least a glimpse of that with Victor Timely in the shot because he's basically a maker or creator like Vulcan or Hephaestus. Have at it, you know, big volcanoes.
Time. What a catch. Excellent catch. Yeah, man. And even the fact that it's a circle of lava makes me think of the symposium because it's a circle of patriarchs talking about love. But yeah, excellent catch. And whenever the flags are on the horizon, those are actually capturing your emotional energy. They're capturing adoration, goosebumps, inspiration. Totally seeding ideas. Nice. That is so obscure. Great catch.
So the guy, Hugo, appears to be the name of the man with the oranges on this cart here. Whenever he was he who remains, he's tossing an apple up and down. But as Victor Timely, he tosses an orange. I don't know. Are we supposed to think like comparing them is like comparing apples and oranges? Maybe to show their similarity yet difference? I'm not sure. But citrus in general is, you know, it's very solar, of course. There's that. I mean, the light of the sun can be orange. That's all fun. Now, another quick freeze frame. If you get just the right frame, you can see Mobius flanked by Buffalo Bill and Annie Oakley of Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, which was an attraction at the Chicago World's Fair. This is a particularly important set piece because it helped firmly set the idea of the Wild West as we later got it in cinema into the public mind. It could very well be mostly made up, a theater of the mind, a way of controlling public perception of the history of America. And of course, it's not lost on me that Bill is the name of the sun. Bell, Bale, Bill, and Annie is Anno, the year. Annie and the oak tree, that's its own big part of it too. Annie Oakley and Buffalo Bill. So just a fun little catch that they make a really brief split second cameo. Like that's the level of detail they go to the trouble of in this series. Why I like it is because you're going to get a 1 second amount of screen time, but they got the whole costume. They got the extras. You know, they weren't shy on the details, which is why I think we should take all of the details as seriously as we can perceive them, you know? Now, this one, so this is where they get onto the Ferris wheel. Loki and Sylvie has entered the scene and she's trying to kill Victor, of course. So there's this tense standoff on the Ferris wheel where Sylvie wants to assassinate Victor Timely, who I now realize the assassination related to World's Fairs is actually a big deal. Like that happened at more than one World's Fair. So it's appropriate that they're doing that in this show. I almost went with there's this. I could only find it in one source, but there's this biblical Hebrew word that seems like it has the root meaning of to protect. And that's what Loki's trying to do here. And it's one of the 2:16s, I think, or one of the 5:10s. I can't remember which, but I couldn't find any good receipts in like the Strong's Concordance. So I left it out of the slides. But what why I'm bringing it up is because in modern Hebrew, the spelling of the word that I was thinking of, it means shit. So I'm like, is he protecting or is he taking a shit? Because like his pose here, sorry for my crudity, but that's what I thought of. Now there's lots of fleeing and fugitive action in this episode. Renslayer is identified by Mobius as a fugitive here. And the entire half of this episode is about Victor fleeing like a fugitive. So this is a connection back to our star card encoding, because the letter Hey, the value of 5, is the same value as Arya, a biblical Hebrew word, whereas a noun, it's fugitive, or as a verb, it's to flee. So that's like a big part of this episode.
Interesting.
Now, another good gematria dig here is this word ayin tav mem, which is a 5-10. It means to be burned. And Loki's like, we need Victor. Don't assassinate him. Without him, the TVA will be destroyed. And she's like, let it burn. And then what happens to the sacrifice victim, you know? It gets burned, of course. That's what Holocaust means, is a burnt offering. So it makes sense that that would be in here. the word that I have up here, it appears in Isaiah 9:18, this autumn. And when you think about it, philologically, T's become D's. So autumn, as this word, is basically Adam again. There's that. And then secondarily, as in the context of Isaiah, where the word is used, it's like, by the fury of the God of hosts, the earth was shaken. Next, the people became like devouring fire. Not one of them spared the others. So there's like the power of a multitude and the locusts, a swarm of it all. And of course, yeah, Resh is a 5-10 when it's spelled out. That's why we're using 5-10s. Then you have 600 in the word shash, I guess. The 600 has a poetic meaning here of white marble. This is also how you spell the word 6 in Hebrew. It's shin. But the white marble is, could be white linen or white marble. I mean, that's this city. The whole city was this white marble. Or plaster, depending on if it was real or fake.
Yeah. Man, that is so interesting that you spell it with a shin, because that's just like digamma. The 6 has some kind of strange superstition around it. I wish I knew more. Like, I wish I knew a lot more, because it's so pronounced. But they don't even call the letter 6 or the number 6. They don't even call it by its own name. They refer to it as twice 3. So digamma is using a prophylactic word to address an idea that I think the Greeks were deeply superstitious about the number 6. And I think they still are. I think this is still a linchpin it's a mystery of mysteries. But you're telling me that even in Hebrew, they had to refer to it as twice 3, shin. So even there, they're using a prophylactic to refer to something without, it's like the number that shall not be named. And I think that the 6 is actually like a poison pill that they let other cultures attach to. And if you're like, yeah, I associate to the 6 in various ways, then it's you've defiled yourself. And those in the know who are like, yeah, these dumbasses, they went and they accepted the 6, but we know better. So it's not just the sex. The sex is the psychological aspect of it. I think there's something even deeper behind the mystery of it all. But I just have to say that because, I know I sound crazy, but Chance, I'm beginning to understand. I'm beginning to overstand that to overstand is to be superstitious. But to understand is to underthrow, is to be a subject. If you're subject, you're saying, I understand. That means, yes, I am the subject. But to be a subject means you didn't throw hard enough. Sub, under, ject, to throw. So if you're subject, you didn't throw hard enough. Your archery isn't very good. You got to draw deeper. You got to get a better draw. And if you want to get a real good shot, you have to be overstanding, which means you have to be superstitious. And now what I'm formulating is something of a new, I'm carving out the new narrative from the sovereignty movement, where they're saying, no, I don't understand. No, I don't understand. I don't stand under this. I do not uphold what you're saying. I think there is a new level of sovereignty where you say, sorry, dude, who I don't know or recognize at all, I am superstitious. I overstand. I don't understand. I overstand. And so the what I'm carving out is that the new sovereignty is superstition. And if you can say, if you can remain superstitious, you'll never get drawn into the liability of saying, yes, I understand. Because as soon as you say you understand, you know you're lying. You know you're lying. So yeah, superstitious is my new stance in life on all things.
I get it, man. I get what you're saying. And I never even thought about that before. The digamma, for everybody to back up, is a letter from the ancient Greek alphabet that was the sixth letter, but it basically was like the Hebrew vav, wow, vav. It could also sometimes, it looked like an F, actually, how it was drawn. But the digamma, that means G twice, or gimel, or gamma twice. So gamma being the third letter, digamma, 2, 3, 23. That's what they're calling 6 in the ancient Greek alphabet. And here we have the word for 6 in Hebrew is shin shin. So there is kind of a digamma thing going on. And that equals 600. The Greek letter that equals 600 is the chi, which looks like an X. The Greek word for 6 is exi in modern Greek. Exi. So there is something superstitious about the 6. I mean, it's the hex. It's not just the sex, it's the hex. I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of it today, but there's something to it.
Something powerful. Yeah, man. And then I got to mention also the WW. Granted, it's a shim shim, but it looks to me like a world war, a WW.
Man, I never thought about it that way. Wow. Makes me think of, you know, one thing that the shin looks like is
it's a wow. Connected. It's a WW.
Wow.
WW is the wow. It's the wow. Chance, we're looking at the wow.
Wow. We found it. We found Owen Wilson's forbidden wow. It was not allowed. Oh, Cheney says W is just 3 on its side. There's something to that. So let's get into the Ferris wheel a little bit. Being on a Ferris wheel, she's... Okay, so Sylvie's like, ready to kill Victor. She says, do you think I'm going to get any joy out of killing that man? If you and the TVA hadn't messed with him, he'd have remained harmless. But now he's going to become the thief of all free will. So first of all, let's anagram Ferris wheel and we get freeze wheel. Freeze will. Phrase will. Frey is a name for the sun. You know that by the 608 that you get when you spell out fee-ro-hey. So here's an example of how words can mean the same thing or the letters change. So we just talked about Finn being 608. Which is phi, eta, none, none. Well, two ins is 50-50. That's 100. A row is 100. So if you swap the ins for an R, essentially, in the Greek system, you go from fen to phrey, but it still has 608. And that's why That's why Frey and Fen are both words that are referring to the, you know, the solar archetype and solar hero. It's also possibly why there's a thing that linguists do not seem to understand. And I don't have a better explanation than this, that in the rules of swapping letters, one of the letter swaps that occasionally occurs is N with R. And it's not like L and R, where you can see how you can make that mistake just with your mouth not doing the right sound because they're close. But N and R, no, they're not really similar. But if you consider it that two N's makes an R in gematria, and two N's together is no different than one N in terms of the sound, well, then you could start spelling things one way or the other way, but you're mystically saying the same thing, which is probably where the N-R swap is coming from. So we're talking about the Ferris wheel, Frey's wheel. Frey's wheel would be the sun, of course. I know. I probably will have to say this a lot of times, but sometimes folks don't get like where or why I bring everything back to the sun, or I assert that the sun has like the primacy in the old system, you know, and I'm happy to talk about pole star symbolism and things like that. And I can see dual symbolism happening simultaneously, but just erase in your head, if you can, all your thoughts about, and all your cosmology about like, what is the sky and what is the earth and what is life? What is the sun? Pretend you don't know any of that, but you've lived about a year, you know, as an adult, and you've seen what happens in the world, you know? So tell me, if without all of the things you've been told by other people, with just the powers of your own observation and life, what the heck is the sun? You know, like if you really get into the minds of the ancients, it's perfectly reasonable to think the sun is God, or that the sun is the representation of God. In fact, it's the most reasonable thing imaginable. Like, there would be no lights. There would be no warmth. It's over. It's over. Of course it's the creator. Of course it's the demiurgos. So there's also the possibility that the sun is what sets everything in motion, or is the wheel that is the will that keeps everything turning. At least in the ancient system, that was definitely the case. And we'll talk more about wheels here. Because one thing that I saw in this shot, you can't see it super well in the screenshot I got, but Sylvie basically like pushes Victor up against the wall with magic. So he's like chained to the wall by invisible chains. So this is very much like an Ixion's wheel thing. Ixion's wheel. We've talked about it in previous episodes, but it's like the myth of Ixion's wheel is that Ixion killed his father-in-law. He was reckoned as the first man guilty of kinslaying in Greek mythology. Zeus took pity on him, brought him to Olympus, introduced him to the table of gods. And instead of being grateful, Ixion got all lusty for Hera, Zeus's wife. Zeus found out about it. And so for some reason, he made a cloud in the shape of Hera, which became known as Nephele, like Nephilim, from Nephos, cloud. And he tricked Ixion into doing it with the cloud Hera. From the union of Ixion and the false Hera came Imbros, or Centauros, who mated with the Magnesian mares on Mount Pelion, according to Pindar, and created the race of centaurs, who are called the Ixionidae from their descent. Ixion was then expelled from Olympus and blasted with a thunderbolt, and Zeus ordered Hermes, that's the Etruscan version, Hermes, to bind Ixion to a winged fiery wheel that was always spinning. Therefore, Ixion was bound to a burning solar wheel for all eternity, at first spinning across the heavens, yada, yada. The point being, my opinion is that this Greek mythology about Ixion and his wheel is potentially like a Middle Ages forgery cover-up of the fact that the crucified savior, whether on a wheel or on a cross, was extant in places like Italy and the Celtic and Gaulish nations and the Scythians, who were Celts, and all over the dang place. Like, when you remember the British getting into India and colonizing it for a while? Well, one of the things that went down is they and the Brahmins worked together, like Sir William Jones, a lot of love for Sir William Jones's work, but guys like him scrubbed the records of Krishna being crucified because it was too heretical to see all the similarities, right? So I think that there's been a long-term project of the church or the ruling class to erase or confuse the crucified savior motif in that it existed way before Christianity. Marty, Gnostic Academy, 33. Thank you for the super chat. Always coming through with big super chats, man. I'm honored. I'm honored that I'm a channel that he actually watches. I have high standards like him. I don't like to watch a lot of stuff. So, but back to this, chaining of him to the wall. That's also kind of like Kronos being chained as well. The god of time that he is. But, all right. It looks like Gabe wants to jump in.
Nobody. Yeah. So the Ixion and the story of Ixion is totally captured in this image right here. You've really nailed the moment. You've captured the spirit of the choreography of the heavens. Because notice even the arched rooftop of the this carousel or whatever, this room on the Ferris wheel that they're moving in, even the arch of the ceiling is perfect because, get my map going here, the Centaurus is right here, and this is the Wheel of Fortune card. It even has the axial spear spearing the lupus wolf on the end of the spear of Centaurus. And so they're under an archway. The roof above his head is even arched. This is the sacred arch of the Ursa Majora. So right now, Ixion is the Crux constellation. That is Victor Timely pinned up against the wall. Loki is playing Centaurus itself. And Lupus, the wolf, the outcast, is, what's her name? Female Loki. What's her name again?
Sylvie, or she could even be Scorpius, too, back there.
Sylvie, because this is silver. This is the wolf, is gray. The outcast, Kaput Garrett Lupinum. He's outlaw. He's cast out from the law. Here's Libra. He's just outside of the law. And now, one thing I love about this map is that it actually is tracking Halley's Comet. And Halley's Comet takes a second to stir its finger in the cocktail cup of the Krator constellation right here. And I just love that Halley's Comet is like God stirring the suicide cup of hemlock that Socrates is about to drink. He's like, let me warm that up for you, buddy. So yeah, I just wanted to put us on the map because here in a second, Ravonna is going to be playing the role of Virgo when she reclines in a chair. So yeah, the anatomy of the heavens is completely being expressed in this scene. I love that you caught the Ixion, which is the Crux constellation. That's the crux of the matter of what they're fighting over, is this little tiny Coptic cross under the legs of Centaurus, who is the protector, like Loki is protecting Ixion right now. And then the Lupus, the whore, the prostitute, the wolf is,
it's so, all there. Yeah. In previous episodes, we talked more about Ixion's wheel and its connection to the dove and to Semiramis or Isis or other queen of heaven archetypes. So it's like we repeat some stuff, but there's more gravy on that in previous episodes of the Demystifiers. It's rich. Very rich. Now, next thing that happens is we have Renslayer asking the cartoon AI clock Miss Minutes for a distraction, and she inflates her size and pretends to be a ghost to scare the people away. And what do you know? Fear and awe is one of the words that the 216, it's Yod Resh Aleph A. And if that's not a direct and intentional symbol of the Holy Ghost, I don't know what would be. But we're going to save that. I'll talk more about the Holy Ghost a little later. For sure, Miss Minutes is the Holy Ghost in this whole allegory, though. It's like they don't play around. It's very clear.
I got something on this chance. Can you make me big? So she's the BC. This is season 2, episode 3. So the BC, the DNA of the savior to come is Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is prone to climb, Bitcoin gone. Climate change and Bitcoin is climbing. Bitcoin is gone. Climate change and Bitcoin are karmically forever intertwined. So the climb bit gone of climate change and the Bitcoin inflating and deflating overnight, I think that just happened this week. I think Bitcoin just had some sort of ridiculous throttling that then settled down to something a little less exciting in a matter of just a few minutes. And so I think Miss Minutes is
No, dude, it is still
articulating
at the
the
all-time high. It's
volatility
way up
potential.
there.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that that just happened the same week with we're doing this episode where Miss Minutes comes out and does the climb bitch agony, climate change, whatever, to get the people moving.
I
Very
could see it
interesting that they
being
have their
seasonal
finger
too,
on
that
that pulse.
we're all feeling the energy go up in the realm as we approach the spring equinox. It makes sense that the climate change of springtime is the Bitcoin climb as well. I think that makes sense.
It's interesting. It's like they found another thermometer to fit up your ass that you didn't even know was there. There's another thermometer up your ass. You had no fucking idea. How many thermometers are you going to fit up your Procyon?
Yeah, moving on. That's hilarious. It's true though. All these different metrics. Loki and Mobius escape on a double bicycle. I just think that's funny. That's why I got a screenshot of that. That unfortunately you don't see them actually riding it. That would have been great. Now, the next scene is we're now in the interior of Victor Timely's pad in Chicago. And the first shot we get to establish that we're in a new scene is of this mythological AF looking fish on the wall. So my first thought is like, Dagon, the Phoenician fish god, Dagon? And so I looked into Dagon in my notes and whatnot and found out, oh yeah, Dagon was the father of the gods, which is the same as Cronus or Saturn or Jehovah. There's only really one source on Phoenician mythology. So whether or not it's accurate or real. Oh, go
Oh.
ahead, Gabe.
I'm having a crazy epiphany. Dagon is a slick of schizophrenic anagram for understand. And understand is an Italian inside joke for capisci. And capisci is the Pope's hat. The mitre hat is a cap. Pisci. It's a Pisces hat. So capisci means do you understand? The word Dogon is a strange anagram for understand. So somehow capisci, the fish, the puns are translinguistical chance. This is like, it's too profound how it's not different. How it's not different. We're making the same mouth noises, but we're still saying because the reason this is consistent is because the Dogons gave us understanding. They granted understanding to humanity, and their name is an anagram for understand. I tell you what, man, I'm more superstitious every day. I ain't understanding
I
shit.
don't I
I'm
I'm
overstanding
gonna be
everything.
I can't read understand out of Dagon. Is there any way to help me do that? It's
Yes.
not working for me.
Yes. It's a schizophrenic. It's a schizophrenic because let me see. Because let me do it. Dagon. Yes. Gosh. It's really okay because of the N to the R. Okay, let me. There are a few rules with schizophrenic anagrams. You can multiply any consonant. So if you need the N to be an N, it can also birth the R that you're looking for. So we got the D, the G, and the N, but we also can birth a R out of there. And right, and then you with schizophrenic anagrams, you can repeat any consonant or you can contract the consonants down to one. So yeah,
Okay.
N D R. No, it's not there. You know what it is? It's Aegon. It's the Aegon is what it is. It's of
It's
Aegon.
the age in it,
And the
for sure.
Aegon is the social agreement to struggle for a common goal. Is the Aegon is like the ego, the ideal, high ideal. It's the light that everybody aims for, is the Aegon. And I guess I'll just leave it with that. That's close enough to understanding for me. But Agon is it's actually a Greek kind of a deified word that has the word zeal and the word victory. It's the child of zeal and victory, had a baby, and its name was Aegon. And this is what everybody's going to strive towards. This is the understanding of the society to work to understanding, to a common understanding.
Well, Dagon being the father of the gods, that connects him to Kronos, the time god, or Saturn, father of the gods. If you read the G like a gamma that can make a Y sound, then Dagon, you know, and you say you're the D a little sharp like a T, now you've got Tion. Tion ton Ionon. Ion ton Ionon. You know, that's getting us very close to Ion, the Mobius, that whole thing. But it's also 128. That name is a 128, which is a multiple of 64, which is a very strong programming number. But back to the mythology of the Phoenicians, we don't really know because there's only one source from the ancient authors, assuming that it's real, Philo of Byblos in the Sanchinuithon, something like that. So it's the Book of Phoenician Mythology, allegedly. And according to Philo of Byblos, Dagon actually was a word that meant grain. And when I found that in my notes, I was like, oh, of course. That completely syncs his name to the meaning of Kronos, because the Kronos comes from the root KRN or QRN, which is a seed or corn. So bam, there's that. So like the Dagon and Kronos have the same meaning of the word as a word outside of it being a god. Also, when you look at the fish head, it does have a horn-like thing going on with its mouth. What's in the bag? Is it seeds? And another trippy thing is, like, this is a colored, sorry, this is a colored version of Dagon carving or something, or a relief. And look at his wrist. Does that look like a wristwatch to you? I mean, must be just a bracelet or something, but God of time, indeed. And
Whoa.
I'll make sure we're zoomed in
Oh.
on the Pope with his fish hat, of course. The bishops are the
Yeah.
Pisciculi, the little fishes. And that's actually before they were called Christians, they were called Pisciculi. And like they're the little fish of Vishnu, really. The funny thing is, I've been going through Dune, and there's this fourth book of Dune where it gets really crazy.
The
God
fact that
Emperor of
it is.
Dune. And the God Emperor of Dune is like a self-created demiurge worm man, Yaldabaoth. And he creates like the golden age of Saturn, essentially, in the narrative. And he has an entire priesthood that is also his military, and they're all women. And he calls them the fish speakers. So one of these days, I got to just go through all of the fucking gravy in Dune, the books. Like, that guy knew some stuff about the system. Everything's so consistent. But yeah, why would we see this Dagon fish in the very first establishing shot of Victor Timely's home? I doubt that he's into fishing. So, and it's a very Eastern looking fish. And of course, the Phoenicians would have been the Eastern arm of the Basilocratic Empire that was whatever was the precursor to Rome, but possibly centered in Italy. And I just think, yeah, Dagon must be, we must be getting the wink that Dagon is a version of Kronos. That's what makes sense to me. Oh, not to mention that the Jesus fish is the ichthys, which is a fish. There's so many things to deal with all that. The original ichthys being potentially a six-spoked wheel, back to your six. We could go on. It just spirals out when we try to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I like how his arms kind of look kind of weird, how he's like, his elbows are kind of overlapping. It almost looks like his arms are in the shape of the tail of a fish. You know, the fact that they're, I don't know, off to the side, they almost look like he's making a fish gesture with his arms. Yeah, yeah, totally. Isn't that a, you know, walk like an Egyptian? That's like one of the telltale symbols of walk like an Egyptian. But that ain't Egyptian.
So this is one of my favorite things in the episode. And I wanted to just ask you, Gabe, why do you reckon they'd show us that Victor Timely really wanted to show Renslayer his special invention, the refrigerator chair?
Man, well, I will say one thing, because right now she, Ravonna is playing the star card. This has a strong Aquarius correspondence, because it's in the winter time of year. This card signified Terpsichore, the muse of dance. And I've been pondering and meditating, like, why is the dancing muse in the wintertime? And what I came up with is that we're all dancers in the winter because we're sliding on ice. And when you slip and slide on ice, you need impeccable balance. And so for her to be put in a position to, like, be wooed or wowed or impressed by his refrigerator, it's kind of like she's being put on ice in an interesting way. But she also has these two cups. She's got like the two goblets or chalices, one above and one below. Here we go. Yeah, so I have her upside down in case people are wondering. This is what she really looks like normally. But I've put her in a back handspring for the spring, for the leap year. This is in honor of the leap year that happens every 4 years. So this is a bit of a vote of offering. So, but this is also the Eridanus River that runs backwards, kind of flowing against time. If it's flowing down like water should, it actually goes against the flow of time. It runs from March backwards almost into February. Those are all my thoughts of why he's pulling something out of an ice chest to impress her.
Well, it's a refrigerator chair. He's an inventor. And the myth of Hephaestus, after his rejection from Hera, he creates her a nice golden throne, but she gets stuck to it by his clever design. So here we see a refrigerated chair is what he invented. It's a freezing chair. Eh? It's the golden throne of Hera. Eh?
That's amazing, Chance. That's amazing.
So
I love it.
I'm saying
I love it.
Renslayer, I'm pegging Renslayer as the queen of heaven. So either Hera or Rhea, either one applies. Just as Victor is both Kronos and Adonis and Adam and Hephaestus and Hermes, all of them having traits of them all because they're allegory for aspects of one being, the sun or God, in the different angles of the year. You can even make a case that Renslayer's hat has a peacock feather or something very much like it. Couldn't find any images of the hat close up and well lit to know, but we could just pretend it's a peacock feather, which is a symbol of Hera. But there's definitely a big role reversal going on in this episode where instead of Hera rejecting Hephaestus, Hephaestus is rejecting Hera. So this, this is it, man. It's Hera in the chair. It's a freezing chair. She's frozen to the chair. It's got to be. I don't know why else they would do it, because he's Hephaestus. Nice. He's Vulcan.
Nice.
I knew you'd see it. When it occurred to me, I was like, no way.
Totally. Totally. And, you know, in this scene, it's kind of interesting because trying to woo Renslayer, we find out later that there's some kind of weird thing going on with him and Miss Minutes. So it's like there's some jealousy, some unspoken jealousy in the subtext here. And this is very interesting because of the number 8 has the lust. And before I did the maneuver, we had the lust card, the Leo card, and the star card were both related to the number 8 position here in this Leo aspect of the number 8. So I see the lion is very much Miss Minutes. She's like a combination of the strength combined with Hera because of the white. She's got white gloves, so she has equity. But the star card was in the number 8 position. So Miss Minutes and Renslayer are both relating to this controller, lusty, domineering aspect. Which has a strong draw to the number 2, to the giver. So there's a controller and a giver. And it's funny because, like, he is giving her the attention, but Miss Minutes is the one who's like, oh, hey, give me some of that attention. Don't forget about me. She's keeping track of who is favored by his admiration.
Yeah, there's a bit of a weird love triangle going on here. And Miss Minutes is the lusty one. So I see why you're saying that. Now, we should talk about Miss Minutes, the Holy Ghost, because this is a point where she starts trying to butt in on their flirtation. And Victor says, is this apparition your helper? And as soon as we get apparition and helper, I'm like, okay, for sure, Holy Ghost, because in the Johannine Gospels, or I guess not Gospels, but books of the Bible, the ones attributed to John the Baptist, he refers to the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost as Parakletos, or in English, the Paraclete, which is the divine advocate or helper or companion. And obviously, that's what this apparition is. It's a helper and a companion of sorts. The word Parakletos in gematria is 810 in the ancient Greek gematria, which really shows the system that I'm talking about. One of the things about the system is when you get into numbers where there's a zero, you drop the zero, or you can drop the zero, and you're considered the same as, you know, zeros are like a blank space, you know, skip the zero. So basically, the fact that Parakletos is 810 means we can think about 81, which is the number for the magic square of the moon. And a lot of words with 81 as a value are lunar in nature. So here we see the three of them are like sun, moon, sun and moon, plus the entire sky or the entire earth, or the earth and the sky, the physical realm, being like the three beings of the Trinity. Parakletos is para, which means beside or next to, and kletos, meaning illustrious or one that is called forth, special boy. Basically, kletos is the same as the same meaning as the elect or the elected or the eklektos, eclectics. The priesthood called themselves this, especially in the Alexandria days when they, you know, when whatever takeover and historical revision was going on. So the Parakletos is the illustrious one called forth to be beside you, which is the invoking of the Holy Spirit. Now, other fascinating connections to this 81, very interesting, is the word that is spelled Teth Beth Ayin, which in English transliterates as TBA or TVA, the TVA, as in Theba or Thebes or Theva. Now think about the god of thieves and think about Thebes with the B and the V swap that happens. Maybe that whole attribution of the savior Hermes Mercury being the god of thieves could be applied to this swap, and we're actually just misunderstanding, and it was Thebes. Because this word, Teth Bet Ayin, Theba, is identical philologically to the word for ark, which is spelled Tav Bet Hey. But, you know, it's just a different version of T. The letters all being interchangeable, that's the word for the ark. So here's a perfect example of the moon and the ark being mystically connected. But the difference is, instead of meaning ark, Teth Bet Ayin or Theba means to sink or to impress, as in an impression made on a coin. So coins are not just minted, they're mooted. The meaning of this word implies that nature is like the impression made on wax by a signet ring impressed with characters written by the hand of God. So God basically smashes down the material, the clay of the world, with his ring that has the impression of his word. And that's how we get the shape of the earth. The earth and the ark are Arga, Eartha. They're the same also in the system, like a macrocosm, microcosm, fractal of each other. So I'm sure you can see the similarity between Miss Minutes, the moon, and a coin. Of course, that's totally there. Other words in Hebrew with this 81 value are fullness, or which is a quality the moon can take on, anger and passion, which Miss Minutes displays later in the episode very clearly, the throne of the third eye, similar to her ability to see and project images across time and space, and also similar to the meaning of Aries, the resh, the gate of wisdom. Another word that means in Hebrew that means 81 is a word for devotion and fervor, also a descriptor of Miss Minutes, interestingly, and visions and revelations, which she provides. In Latin, the word anima, meaning spirit, same as the resh or the ruach, equals 81, as in the anima mundi, the soul of the world, or the spirit of order, because that's what mundi really means. It's like order and beautification, artistic beautification. So I threw up the magic squares of the sun and the moon here because they're fun, especially the one of the moon, because it gives you that 369 repeat, and timely is very Tesla-esque. Carrie Woodsley says hymn print. Yeah, nature is the hymn print of God.
Excellent. Anima mundi is a very profound thing to know of. And so often it's like every episode we do, you and I are brushing up against the anima mundi and differentiating it from anima mechanicus, the animated machine in the mechanics. And it's profound because the science of the machine, it rhymes with the science of the spirit of the realm, of the world, the natural hylozoistic emanations of being. But the anima mechanicus is just a simulacrum. It's just a wannabe overlay. And here it is, right here. It's like he's torn between a real woman or a machine. And sure enough, we'll find out in a second what he chooses, between anima mundi and anima mechanicus.
Good. Yeah, that's a really good point. There's no takesy-backsies either. Once you scorn Hera, you're done. She don't forget. But I just want to further highlight here why I talk about this, why it's important, is because Gematria can prove the fingerprints of the system that existed between cultures and across time. That the word in Greek in the New Testament, parakletos, the 81 of that, is the same as Latin anima, which is the spirit or the breath of God or the soul. So 81 in one language, 81 in another language, different words, same concept, proving the system. this seems to be where we even get a lot of our words. Our language is obviously just dripping with the system, if you will. It's in everything. So either humans did that or God did that. I don't know which. And the funny thing is, language goes so far back, nobody ever did know. Like the people back, like the priests back 2,000 years ago were wondering, like, did God just put these words in our head the way that he did for us to discover that there's this numerical value to it all? And should we make sure that what we come up with matches that value? You know, I don't think anybody knows. It's a chicken or an egg thing, which is part of why the idea of the logos is present. Like we can't ever know. That's the beauty of it. We're always on that coin toss of like, did humans create this incredible system, or is it a product of the spirit coming through us? I kind of like to think the latter, but I also like to think humans did it because I like to imagine that humans have that potential for creative genius and, you know, multi-leveled thinking. So let's just say both for now. And then, of course, we have another repeat of the last time, remember, Timely grabbed at his chest or his solar plexus. He was being called a luminary in a dialogue. This time, he's singular, like Sol Invictus. The sun and the moon are equally singular. So Miss Minutes and Victor tell each other that you are pretty singular yourself. So next we see Renslayer as the child or the product of God, the creator, who is represented by Timely and the Holy Spirit. You know, if they're like the sun and the moon, she's Miss Moonitz. But Renslayer is also Victor's mother because she was the one who birthed him by leaving the TVA Bible in his window when he was a boy. And she's also so clearly flirtatious with him in this scene. So we're really getting that mythos of the self-generating Trinity, the mother whose son is her husband, and also the husband is the mother's creator. Victor creates Miss Minutes. Miss Minutes shapes or informs or trains Renslayer. Renslayer initiates Victor. Victor creates Miss Minutes. It's a circular process of creation, just like the sun and its seasonal journey through the year. And this is the perfect time for us to break down Renslayer's first name, because he's like, and you, Mrs. You know, he says Mrs. because he wants to know if she's free or not. And she gives her first name to him, which is Ravona. We haven't fully really thought about what that name Ravona means, but this is the perfect episode to make it make sense. So first is R-A-V. In Hebrew, you could spell that Resh Ayin Vav, which is Rah or Rav, a guide or a friend. Or you could spell it as Resh Aleph Vav. Either way, you could spell it either way. The second spelling would be to perceive, to investigate, or to understand. And Anno, you know, Ravona, O-N-N-A, put that backwards, it's Anno, the year. So there it is. Ravona is the guide to the year, or the friend of the year, or the one who understands the female generative power. Because Anno, forgot to say, Anno is also like phonetically like the Yuna, or the, you know, O-N-N-A, A-N-N-O, whichever way you put it. Yuna is the dove, or the Yoni, the dove of Semiramis or Aphrodite or Mary. So yeah, Ravona, guide to the year, friend of the year, one who understands the year or investigates the year, or the guide or friend or investigator or understander of the female generative powers, or both. And in a wild synchronicity here, I just threw in Ravona in the most basic way you'd spell it in Hebrew gematria, just to see what would fall out. And it's Resh Aleph Vav Ayin Nun Nun Aleph. And what do you know? It's 314, which is pi. There's pi again. And what is it that you need to understand the year? What do you need to understand or measure a circle or a cycle's circumference? You need pi. That's the guide to the year, or to the circle or the cycle. So bam, there's like a lot in her name. I think this was definitely the perfect time to really dig into it.
Yeah, buddy. So we actually did In earlier episodes, when we were getting acquainted with Ravonna, we correlated her to the universe card, because Ravonus is an anagram for Universe. Can you pop up the most recent one? But this is her early. This is in her authority when she's working for the TVA in her uniform, wearing a whole nother motif. She has fulfilled the universe card, and also very correspondent to the Hierophant when she's playing the judge, the role of that judge. But I just thought I would share that generally I would associate her with the universe we have in the past. But she's in a whole new role for this episode. She actually has kind of walked away from that, and now she's kind of gone rogue. So yeah, putting her on in a different light as the in that star card with this new costume is very apropos. Yeah, man. Yoniverse. Better listen to them ladies. A lot of wisdom coming out of them ladies.
Just maybe don't put him in charge. No offense, ladies. Okay. And next in the slides, got to get out of my arrangement. There we go. Oh my gosh, what's happening? Stop. Okay, everything just went nuts. Give me a second. Let me fix my PowerPoint.
We got quite a time jolt.
Yeah, it just skipped me all the way to the end somehow. And it's not sharing the right thing. So
spoiler.
This whole show is spoilers. That's all we do. Okay. Did this come up? All right, cool. Now I just got to skip back to where we were. Oh, man. We've come a long way already. The thing I was most excited for, I think, was to drop the the freezing chair of Hera on you. That was fun. All right.
Yeah, man.
Okay, so this is the point where next, Ravonna and Miss Minutes, they throw Loki under the bus to persuade Victor not to trust the wizard and his butler because he switches sides. He plays both sides because he's Mercury, of course. Then we see Timely in this episode. He throws out a lot of French phrases. In particular, when they ask him about if this is his home, he says, no, this is just a pied de terre, which means foot on earth. That's a phrase that was used, I think, by crusaders originally, or knights of some kind, to refer to like a just little shack that they would post up in when they were on a journey, one place to another. It's just where they would stop, put their foot on the earth, as in get out of the saddle and go to sleep, and then get back on the horse the next day. So he just uses this to go and sleep in between making sales in Chicago, but his lab is in Wisconsin. That's where he gets lower taxes. You see here, they're escaping from the room through the window, through the hay. They're going through the, you know, we see that repeatedly in this episode, just so we're sure to be thinking about the star card of the hay. And usually there's some illumination very present, but not always. Sometimes that's the lack of illumination. Then they come out of the window, and I see this little booth that's a honeycomb. I couldn't help but think about what we talked of previously, that during the World Fair of Chicago, there was a famous serial killer at that time, and his name was H.H. Holmes. So if you just like drop the oni of the honey and look at it like H.H., it's, and then, you know, you make the comb C more like a, then you have H.H. Holmes. I think that's the reference. I don't know. Maybe it's just honey comb for no reason other than as a prop, but that's what I think about. There's a killer on the loose, you know, because they're running through the streets. There's a threat and danger. I feel like that makes sense. The angry robber baron is here. Our heroes are looking around for Timely, and they're having no luck. They get called rat bags. Very inconsiderate.
So Chance, I got a loose dangling chad from the last episode, and this was a late epiphany. Can you bring up the most recent graphic in the Telegram that I sent to you? This has to do with remember the scene where Victor Timely receives the TVA manual through the window, and we mentioned the veil of the window, the curtain of the window, being a veil. Well, it turns out, I think that there is a nod to this book that is the original generative seed of science fiction. And I highly recommend people look into this fascinating phenomenon from history, air quotes. In the history of this seed of science fiction is tightly interwoven to the World's Fair. You can see by the timeline here. It's called A Dweller on Two Planets, or it's also named The Dividing of the Way. It's a book written by Frederick Spencer Oliver, who was born in 1866. Interesting fact, Gurdjieff is reported to be born in 1866, but that's a lie. He's actually, he dates to 1877, which is the same year Lady Freda Harris was born. And that's fascinating because my whole project is Gurdjieff's design with Lady Freda Harris's art. So that's just a fascinating thread. But this child is said to have channeled an amazing fictional story of a sci-fi future that is puts Philip K. Dick and all the sci-fi writers to shame on the first go. And so I think there's a strong thread that they are hinting or nodding at the power of this seed of science fiction. It is so profound. And it is said to also have a strong root in Atlantis mythology. But one of the reasons, many reasons why I think that there's a powerful relationship between the two is because in his futuristic sci-fi reality, they say that people were flying around on veils. The veil is the flying mechanism in that future. And I just find that profound because Valis is one of P.K. Dick's like psychic pink connecting thread that is today is T-Mobile. The T-Mobile pink magenta placenta theme is a collectivism spell of Philip K. Dick's Valis, which is basically the all-seeing collective panopticon of interlinking gnosis that is themed with the pink. So yeah, I just wanted to kind of thread the original seed of science fiction to the Victor Timely window, because we're looking for windows in time when history changed and this little story changed science fiction forever. So I think it's a very powerful correspondence.
I want to first reference PK's comment here because he says he does his sales in Chicago and then lives in Wisconsin for tax reasons or some shit. But PK is right. I don't think they were paying income tax in 1893. That might be some kind of programming or not programming of us, but just they're programmed in the authors and they didn't even think twice about it. Who knows? The legal history of income tax is a checkered thing. And I believe the first time it ever got instituted was temporarily during the Civil War. And then off and on again until finally they got people to buy it permanently. But concerning what you just said, and with this, what's it called? The name of this book, A Dweller on Two Planets or The Dividing of the Way. Okay. So check this out. In your image here, it says, in its introduction, Oliver claims that the book had been channeled through him via automatic writing, blah, 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 by a spirit calling himself Philos, the Tibetan. What did I just talk about? Okay, so we were talking about Sanchaniuthon or Sanchaniathon, the only source of Phoenician mythology written by Philo of Biblos. Okay, Biblos is the Bible, the book. The Phoenicians were the people of the book. Their capital was allegedly Biblos. Philos of Biblos. So there's that. The eclectic sect is one of the big important names of the eclectics, or the therapeutes of Egypt, where it was Philo the Jew, referenced by Eusebius a lot. But that's aside. He's Philos the Thebetan. That's TBE. That's Thebes. That's TVA. Like, literally, it might as well say it was written by Pyle, which is a word for a gate or wisdom, the TVAN, the Tibetan, the Theban, Thebes. You know, even in Egypt, the city of Thebes was the Phoenician capital for a time when they held the Egyptian empire. So, like, the fact that he's saying that the spirit that he channeled is Philos the Tibetan automatically makes the whole thing super sus. Like, he's part of the oligarchy of the priesthood that's been writing history for everybody for all this time. Super sus, dude. Philos the Tibetan. Come on. You can't get that shit past me.
Yeah, man. It's almost the Pharaoh of Tavistock is almost what I see there. The Pharaohs of Tavistock. But the story is
Philos really, and Pharaohs, same word.
Yes. But the things that come through are actually what's amazing is that it's way above the pay grade of anybody that doesn't have technology at their fingertips. The story is really far out, and it's an old story. Mark from My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, he's very familiar with this thread. So be interesting how this resonates for him.
Well, sci-fi is riddled with this, like Dune, what I keep referencing. This guy was writing before the internet or before personal computers, and he was writing about a far-flung future where humanity had already seen the rise of thinking machines and artificial intelligence, and they had a whole universal jihad against it to make it taboo permanently. And the God Emperor of Dune says stuff like, when you have the creative or imaginative machines in your society, it makes people ignore each other. And I'm like, how do you know that? How do you even know that? Like, there was no such thing in your time. Like, the weird thing about Dune as a sci-fi is the whole book is centered around prophecy and large cycles of time, but it reads like prophecy of the next cycle of time that was to come after Frank Herbert's time. So yeah, there's something there. Sci-fi is, there's something there with sci-fi.
Yeah, man. One thing I hold on to like a precious gem about Dune is that the original stories, the character's internal monologue was actually broadcast through the writing and even in the film. You were actually privy to their internal thoughts. And it was in the actor's voice, echoing like in an empty room, the way they portrayed it. So you could literally hear their thoughts kind of like reverberating a little bit. That's how you could distinguish it from their actual speaking voice. And the new Dune, that's not even a part of the plot line at all. It's not even, it's like they didn't find that interesting as an artifact to carry forward. But by removing it, it actually makes it more important, because I have learned that there are people in this world who don't even have an internal monologue. Oh, nice. Big up. To find out that some people don't even talk to themselves within their own headspace. They don't even have, and they don't fill spare time with random conversation with themselves. And that they have maybe even extremely prolonged periods where there's nothing going on inside. That realization it boggles me. I'm not concerned, but it's just unique, because I don't have any dead airtime in my head, in my gigantic chamber. I am constantly having many conversations all the time. I can't imagine how boring it would be not to be that way. But long story short, I believe that not having internal monologue is actually beneficial for the powers that presume to want to be. And I think they want to breed out your internal monologue. I think this hails to the motto of NATO is a mind unfettered with deliberation. This is the delta. These are the deltas of Orwell. These, some people would say that's what they want the Chinese to be like, that the Chinese have such a hive mind that they are a quintessential delta. And they don't even have any internal deliberation of, do I want Pepsi or do I want Coke? They just go along, get along. So these are profound artifacts. I just wanted to put on your radar because I know you're digging into Dune, that the internal monologue is a treasure of that story. But then the other treasure is the language of compulsion, that the royals actually have a language that can make people do what they're told, that makes them circumvent their free will. And I think that this Frank Herbert is preserving another treasure that could be a language that has true purchase to causality built into the very fundamentals of every sentence is true purchase on causality. And I think the English language is watered down. I think it's watered down. We don't have the causality we thought we had. And you need years and years and years of training in captured terms of art, captured terms of art, that if you don't have the paperwork to wield those terms, you don't get purchase on causality. This is what they did with the legal system, and we know it.
Well, let me offer, first of all, thank you, Cucumber, for this generous super chat. He says, I wonder how to explain to an Amish fellow what a computer is and can do. That'd be fun. But I want to offer this possibility, because I'm obviously doing just a fiction and an allegory, but in that framework, it's not the words themselves that have purchase on compulsion or on causality. It's the tone and the posture and the resonance of the word. So it's my opinion that it's not so much about the word itself, but it's about how it's about the energy and the coherence behind it, you know? And that, when you're talking about the internal monologue and the mind fettered by deliberation and never having any dead air in your mind, there's a possibility that the person who exists without the internal monologue is actually the one who is whole, that they're just there in the moment. And there's not the schizophrenia of a cacophony of voices clamoring for their attention as different thoughts at any given time. I'm not saying one way or the other. I'm just putting it out there as like, what if the opposite is true? You know, like, what if the internal monologue is a symptom of our fragmented psyche? Who knows? Because who's talking to who in there? Who's talking and who's listening? It's an infinite recursion. I'm the one that notices that something is noticing that there is something to notice, that, but who is the one that's noticing that there's a noticer? And it just goes on. Whereas without any of that, you're just like, you're just here. There's no subject object separation. So which is more coherent? That's the question. But on the other hand, language is the very pickaxe that chips away into the psyche to make the fragmentation. So it's a weird, like, it's a super weird loop of causality that I don't know we ever will get to the end of it in this life.
It is so profound. It is so profound. I think of the sofa ring. The ring of sofas, the sovereigns, and these, you know, the symposium is to some degree a metaphor for doing an internal monologue, you know, talking to yourself about, you know, am I going to eat before I drink? Do I got to go do this before I, you know, getting your priorities in order? And some people have their kung fu quite dialed, so it doesn't look like a process whatsoever. And they seem to be of single-mindedness. That comes with practice. But I think to not have a counsel with yourself is a Yeah, I see what you're saying, that it does come off as being whole. I do see where you're coming from, but it's only a matter of one interloper. One interloper in your entire free will is usurped. So it's almost like the internal council gives us, I don't know, some degree of like, oh, let me think, let me sleep on it. You can make me the offer today, but I'm going to sleep on it, and I'll come back to you with my rebuttal. You know what
Oh
I mean?
yeah,
But
it gives you
if
the
you,
you can look forward and backward.
right,
It makes you multidimensional.
that's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
I could go on. I could start talking about Dune Moore and the God Emperor with his ability to remember all of his past lives photographically and see the future. He's totally Janus. Man, like those later, the movie is wild enough, but those later Dune books, they're off the hook, man. But well, we got to get back into our analysis, buddy. I like this detour, but we got to get back to our analysis. I mean, we don't have to, but I'd like to.
Just got
to
say, I want to say, if he has full access to his past lives, that's placental transmission. That's the placental transmission, to have all your past lives, all the elders there at your beck and call. That's the placental transmission. The Mohadib.
Yeah, he could be them. Exactly. So, okay, so... okay, we were watching the robber baron and the heroes looking for Victor and the ladies. They can't find them because they're hiding in a little hay. Look at that. It's another little hay they pop out of, a little window. Now, then it cuts to a scene where Timely is leading Renslayer and his luggage through a big crowd. And he's, so, you know, there's your crowd or multitude idea again. And he's guiding her straight and directly through, which is this word yashar, which is to make or lead straight. It is to direct or to be pleasing and agreeable. So it's both of those meanings at the same time. And while he's leading and directing, making her, you know, leading her straight through, he's also saying, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, pardon me. You know, he's being pleasing and agreeable. I was like, okay, perfect. That's in there. Then they're getting, okay, yeah, the throng and multitude, right? We're looking at this 205 stuff of the throng and the multitude with the Atzma because of the addition of the Resh plus Hay, the sun and star cards, the sun and Aries, all of that, and the strength in numbers. But continuing to the 205 of it all, it is a really relevant number because these characters are boarding a ship, a decked ship, like the word Safina, which means exactly that and equals 205. It's a decked ship. This is actually the name in the Hebrew convention for the Argo constellation. It's Safina. The boat that they're boarding to cross Lake Michigan is a decked ship. It's Safina, but it's also called the SS Heron. That's like, oh, you have to like, you can't even see this stuff. You have to like brighten your screenshots to even read these little things. But the Heron is a symbol of Thoth, Hermes, or Ptah. In Egypt, it's either a symbol of Thoth in his role as the creator, cosmo creator, or in Greek, the Heron is a messenger symbol for Hermes. But either way, this boat or this Argo is the Ark as well, because it's their salvation from destruction, since the angry robber barons don't follow them here to kill them. And they ride through this boat through the night, and it's the dawn when they get through. So it's like a microcosm of the cycle. They're surviving the winter, the night, etc. And in this moment here in the dark, you really get the symbolism of Miss Minutes and the moon super clear. She's like their only light source in the dark. When the moon hits your eye. You know, all of that. That's Amore. Here we see, this is where we see the TVA handbook again, and Victor starts talking about how he keeps everything he's ever imagined. And since we're on the Heron, it's appropriate to bring up Victor's, the writing Victor's done in his handbook. I like that. Now, we're going to talk about that arc. The word in Hebrew for Noah's Ark, Tav Bet Hey, but remember the alternate spelling, Teth Bet Ayin. It's Theba or TVA, an impression as one made on a coin. The other meaning of this word is nature. The second spelling, Teth Bet Ayin, nature, is the Because nature is like the impression made on wax by a signet ring, impressed with characters written by the hand of God. So he's talking about in this scene, he says, the book was delivered to me when I was a child, dropped into my life by some divine hand. What? That's the hand that wears the signet ring. And this cyclical creating his own nature by impressing upon himself via the divine hand that he himself had leave the book of characters in his window. It's super mystical stuff. And what's even more far out is the meaning of impression, which is coming down and stamping, being like from above, because that's laid up in the word. It also can be used to pertain to sinking, literally the sinking of a ship, further connecting it to the ark. The ark is a ship. It's a vessel to contain the words of God, like the TVA Bible, that are stamped or impressed upon, like, you know, because the ark is also the vessel that contains the tablets of Moses, commandments that were impressed upon, right? And Moses was a baby in a basket, which the word for it is the same as the word they use for Noah's ark. It's Tav Bet Hey. It's a Theba. He's Victor the Thibetan. And in a moment, speaking of sinking, Renslayer is going to get sunk by his nature. His loner nature, all of that is in play. All right, take it away. Making you big. Still muted, homie.
There we go. Thank you. So yeah, at the moment, they're on the boat, and he's discussed this divine hand that dropped the TVA Handbook of Enlightenment, the illumination, onto him. And so this divine hand is very significant because Yod is the glyph on the hermit card. But once he cuts her loose, once he disavows the potential of having her as a partner, she gets dropped. And when she drops, she has a fall from grace. And she becomes vindictive. Oh, for one, she slows down. She's going to slow him down. This is an aspect of sloth. When she gets dropped out of, in that boat, gets dropped down, she is running slow. She's lagging behind while he goes on the big boat. She has to start getting to work to keep up with him. And she eventually catches up later. So she falls out of the number nine. She falls and she goes back to, I think she becomes the universe card again when she pops back on the story here in a little
bit. Especially because she has like a wand or a baton when she comes back.
Yeah, yeah. When she comes back with the vengeance, she's back in her old business mode.
It's business time. So, okay, and then this scene continues, and Ravonna basically claims credit for being the divine hand who drops the book. But then Caddy Miss Minutes is like, you brought it to him the way the postman brings a post. But that's funny because the reference to the postman is perfect for the fact that they're on the SS Heron, the Hermes being symbolized by the Heron, the divine messenger, the mailman. And then we see Victor talks about the TVA handbook being what he thinks is like a dialogue between myself and the visionary author, Ouroboros. And the Ouroboros of it all is very encapsulated by this episode because we learn that the future Kronos, which has the root meaning of seed, sent back the seeds of his own creation into the past, and that those seeds sprouted and were handed off to Ouroboros, who wrote the book that inspired the seeds to sprout. It's like, who actually invented all the TVA technology? Was it Ouroboros or was it Victor Timely or a version of him? There's no beginning or no end. That's what makes it a cycle or a circle. And there's lots of symbolism in this, and I'll just leave out the gematria part because I feel like I'm going overboard with that. But he does hand Renslayer she's flirty with him. She says, I'm starting to see the man you'll become. Teehee. And he hands her a paper mache origami flower. It's like a lily. So this is the lily or the lotus that the supreme deity is born out of. It's actually another symbol of the ark because it rests on the water and it requires the filth or the mud or the darkness for the flower to blossom. So you see the lots of versions of the deity on the lily pad or on the lotus flower. And that's the reason. Also, the lotus is a symbol of the third eye, the Resh, the gate to wisdom. So bigly important, especially that it's made of paper. It's a paper lily. Okay. Now, another fun bit of gematria that is, I think, worth talking about is, well, this is the big role reversal moment. Instead of Hera rejecting Hephaestus, he rejects her. So in the Greek mythology, Hera, who is Hephaestus' mother, thinks that he's just too ugly. So she throws him off Olympus, throws him off the mountain. Remember that the mountain and the ark are dual symbols for the same thing. And here he throws her off of the boat mountain, which it makes sense. It makes sense that she needs to go into the water because she's been the queen of heaven archetype in this episode. You know, the love interest to Kronos. So she's like Ma, Rhea, Mary, Aphrodite, Venus, all the rest of the watery, oceany goddesses. So she's got to go into the water, the mare. Metaphorically, she walks the plank. You know, that's what they call it when you get thrown overboard, walking the plank. Funny enough, plank in Hebrew, the word for plank is 600. I don't know why that is. If you spell out the word for water, mim, as it is mystically spelled in plentitude, which would be mim, yad, mim, yad, vav, dalet, mim, yad, mim. Then it becomes 200, like resh. So here's another mystical link between water and the sun, because of course the sun cannot create without water, but water cannot be water without the sun. So they need, there's this weird dual thing going on because water would be ice if it wasn't heated by the sun. And then there's another thing that happens in Hebrew where if you put the mem at the end of a word, it becomes called mem sofit and has a different glyph, or they call it mem final. And that actually goes from a value of 40 to 600. So there it is, there again, two ways to look at it. The mem connecting to the sun. And who knows, maybe the sun is the recorder of memory of the whole cosmos because it requires witness to form a memory. And the sun is the big eye in the sky, you know, or maybe the moon and the sun together are the recorders or the stars are involved. Just spitballing here. But I think it's funny that she gets thrown overboard. She has to walk the plank and we can get all of these 600s out of it. And like, look at her face as she's having to row the boat. I mean, is that not Hera stuck to the Chera, like super pissed? And so I want to talk about some more 600 stuff though, because I mean, it is really relevant. This is a microcosm of the cycle because she goes into the water, they get on the boat at night, and then at the climax, it's dawn. So that's a new cycle. That's just, it's what it is. Microcosm, macrocosm. So in Hebrew, there's a phrase, the word for dawn is Theo Shahar. I think that's how you'd say it. And if you put a hey in front of it, like the, then it becomes Hey Theo Shahar. And that equals 600 and it's the dawn. But in Greek, it's Hey Theotes. In Greek, Hey Theotes is 600. In either case, the phrase the dawn is like D-A-W-N, although that's cognate to dawn, as in the Lord, D-O-N, or dawn, like in Adonis, or a lot of rivers have the phrase dawn in it. So it's a solar god, water type of word as well. But whether it's the Greek Hey Theotes or the Hebrew Hey Theo Shahar, it is 600. So it's a perfect example of how the system works, where spelling changes as the powers of notation change between alphabets because the alphabets have been improved upon. It's exactly like the name of the Lord or the sun, Frey, Phi, Rho, Eta, 608, being the same as Fin, which is Phi, Eta, Nun, Nun, 608. Or drop the Eta, the vowel, in either, and it's 600, the old number of the cycle, because later it was 608. And then other times, and with other Colts, it was 650. But you can kind of pinpoint what era of the Colt and place you're looking at by what number they give to this cycle. But either way, she's rowing for the morning. Hey, Theotes. So let's also think about the name of the mother of Achilles, Achilles being a very early archetype of this savior. Thetis. Hey, Theotes. Theotes. Basically, Thetis, the mother of Achilles, is the same as the word for dawn. And she's the mother of the savior. She's said to be a water nymph in later Greek mythology, but there's actually a written record, a fragment that exists attesting to her worship, and that there's an early Alcman, I don't know where that is, him, that exists that identifies Thetis as the creator of the universe. So, like, we just get the Iliad version. She's Achilles' mother. She dips him in the water to make him invulnerable, but his heel sticks out. But by the way, Achilles getting shot in the heel, that's how Krishna dies, gets a wound in the heel. By the way, just putting that out there, not very well known, a little factoid, but she's a Mary figure, easily enough. And I wanted to just point that out, how, like, she's rowing for the dawn. The dawn is what gives birth to the new sun. You know, like, it's all part of the system. And all in all this androgynous way. Pretty fun. And I really like these examples that show you how spellings change, but the meaning stays the same numerically and definitionally.
Yeah. I help me out here. I believe there's a Greek word for the ocean that is thelete. Is that correct? Does that sound familiar to you? Thelete?
I know okeanos.
Or
thelete.
Yeah, thelete. Okay.
There's Thelete, who is a daughter of Dionysus and a river god.
Okay. Yeah. It's just I remember this as in Xenophon, in his Anabasis, the story of his retreat, the soldiers at the front of the line start crying out, and he thinks it's a battle, and he thinks this is the big showdown. And it turns out what they're crying out is ocean, the ocean. And it becomes like a memory, a joyful memory for the Greeks to be like, we made it to the ocean. It's the end of our adventure. So I thought,
all I can think of, also racking my ocean brain on Greek. Yep. I took some Greek lessons, and thalate is the second person way of saying, like, you want, like, thelete ligo krasi, you want some wine, like, thelete, it means, it's like a word, a verb referring to want or desire. But I don't know about ocean. I need to get back into taking Greek lessons to actually be able to speak it. It's pretty fun. I like the rhythm of it.
Yeah, man. So I want to talk about the Achilles heel being a vulnerable, and that having an earlier incarnation in Hindu mythology.
Actually, no, the Achilles version in my book is older, because like Achilles goes back to the Etruscans, and there's artifacts that are older than Krishna artifacts. It's one of those examples of, like, where did it come from earlier in terms of what we can physically find? So I think it's west to east, not east to west, in terms of that.
Nice. I think that we could surmise that this the vulnerability of the heel is kind of, I think there's a dark wordplay or a dark punning going on, because we know that our language of the subconscious is implying things that are from underneath. It's right under your nose. And if it's right under your nose, you're taking it for granted. It's the best place to hide things. So your base desires, your animus, your animal instinct, it's like so close that you overlook it. And it turns out when you come to overstand and you look down upon yourself, all along, our language is anatomical in profound and fun ways. But what I'm getting at is I think part of this sea urchin and alarmist catastrophe language is baked into many cultures. I don't think it's unique to the English language. And I think this using seashore metaphors to insinuate fearful images or fearful concepts is, I think it's been baked into other languages. And I think that is the Achilles heel. It's almost like a kill switch or a back channel cancel program, execute order 66. And I think this is where what we consider healing is actually the heal lang. This is the language that is speaking to your weakness. And so the healing language is intrinsically vulnerable. This is why the word rape is still in the word therapy. The word rape has to stay in the word therapy, because when you engage in therapeutic practices, you are being vulnerable. You have to agree from the jump that, yes, I'm going in here vulnerable, like a child, and I'm subjecting myself to somebody else's opinion because I believe that they're going to heal me with their opinion. And so this weakness of the Achilles heel and the heel language of what I've been unpacking from the sea urchin, seashore emergency, Carrie Mullisk spell, I think it's been imbued into other languages, in other cultures. And I think it's even a treaty that it's required that other languages have had the same weak spot of implying sea urchin, spiny things that are going to take the standing out from under you so that you don't have good standing. And this is exactly what they do in the courts. So yeah, I think that is the Achilles heel, is that all of our languages have a kill switch to pull your confidence out from under you. And it's baked into the words we choose around crisis.
And there's lots of examples of that. Like, you know, where to do one thing, you're symbolically doing the opposite. You know, like think about symbolically what it means to turn your back on somebody, right? But turning your back on them is also a symbol of opening up your vulnerability to them. So you think one thing like, oh, I'm showing them, I'm gaining the power on them, I'm leaving them behind, but you're also exposing your back to them. You're giving them the power. There's like tons of these little paradoxes. I find that interesting. I mean, even in this gematria of I feel on the screen here as well that the 510 of the rash and the sun.
One more thing.
Oh, sure.
I just wanted to maybe bring everybody's thoughts to, can you recall the last time you really felt that sinking feeling? That sinking feeling is the sense of betrayal, the sense that you walked into the trap, the sense that there's no turning back, that it's all decided from here on. And that sinking feeling is also having the earth pulled out from under you when you're standing on the ocean shore. And if you stand there long enough, what you thought was ground is no longer ground, and you're already burying yourself by not doing anything. If you sit there with that sinking feeling long enough, you just end up under the earth. And so the sinking feeling is like, I'm not doing anything and I'm already dying. And you can feel it anatomically. And so our language around that sinking feeling is literally bringing you into the ocean so you can feel the earth be pulled out from under your feet. And I have had this happen to me in ways I will never forget. And because I had that experience, I can bring people's language back to the fact that we are invoking these emotional states. And so when she gets betrayed and gets launched down on the ship and sold upstream, she has that sinking feeling. But as soon as you get that feeling, you just roll up your sleeves and start working twice as hard.
Yeah, but she gets her power back. It's like the idea that the sinking of the signet ring, you know, in that word, Tef, Bet, Ayin, Teva, Teba, that the nature is created by the impression of the sinking down and pressing down from above, from God. Now think about creation in the microcosm of your life. Like, what happens when you reach your low point? The only way from there is to create a new self or create a new identity to rise from the ashes like the phoenix. So we're talking about the cycle, of course. Or when when a mother is about to do the, or some, a woman is going to do the process of the creation of life, her energy collects in her belly. So it's like sinking. Or in the like energy traditions of the East, you know, the idea of, we talked to Mark English about this, of creating like a, your next body, being the pregnant man energetically. Like, a big part of the technique is sinking the chi. You sink your chi down into your dantian. So like, there is this interesting thing. You gotta get down to get up. You know what I mean? You gotta get up to get down. You gotta get down to get up. Like, there's this paradox to it for sure. And
so true.
Another 510 that I didn't put into the slides anywhere, but I thought is relevant. So the very same letters as how you spell Resh, you rearrange the letters and you get Sarai, which is Abraham's wife, which is the wife of Brahman, same as Rhea, wife of Kronos, same concept. And also pertains to rivers. You know, they name rivers after her. In the Hindu, it's Saraswati, but it's the same thing, Sarai or Resh, same letters. And she's totally that. But she's also Nyx, you know, she's the daughter of chaos. She's the order born out of chaos, which we see in the scene following this big time. Because Nyx in Greek is nu, upsilon, and the old Greek, chi, which is different than the newer chi, which is both of them are kind of like an X. Anyway, I'm going to move us on. We're getting into some good weeds though. I like it. Yeah, this is the last scene. They come into this is a really good word. Okay, so another word that's a 510 is where, I'm pretty sure where we get the word elite. So it's Ayin, Lamed, Yad, Tav, like Alit, Olit in Hebrew. And it means either, it can mean an upper room or a loft, which is where he's at. He's in a loft. It's to climb or to ascend. Well, the sun is now climbing and ascending because we've reached the dawn. It also can mean superior. So I think this is the root of the word elite, is this solar word, Ayin, Lamed, Yad, Tav, which is cool. Now, where is my notes? Okay. And yeah, of course, because he's the sun card. He's Resh. He's the beginning figure. It's fitting that he's got a loft for his quarters. I mean, I could be wrong, but this looks like a loft to me. That's just what it looks like. Maybe I'm wrong. The mannequins in here are also perfect symbolism for him as the demiurge or creator of humanity, at least in this metaphor. He's creating their fates and their destinies. I mean, why else would you have all these mannequins other than that he's shaping and molding humanity through his future to create the sacred timeline? There's also in here a Tesla orb that I thought was pretty cool. Where's my, okay, here we go. This Tesla orb is like on his desk. So we're getting another cool connection to Tesla. These orbs were patented in 1894, 1 year after this setting. So maybe it's an anachronism, or maybe it was something that was known about previously, or we're just supposed to see it and not think about it twice. Then he then he digs out the invention that he was looking for, the time throughput multiplier, right? And he holds it up. It's just like, you know, it's just like the battle horn or the cornucopia or the raising of the brazen serpent is all of this stuff. The Hebrew phrase, he lifted up a horn, as it appears in Psalms, is equal to 600. And I forgot to mention that Moses has horns in all the ancient depictions of him. That's a thing. So then we get into this really weird part of the scene where all of a sudden Miss Minutes is like, will you sketch me like your French girls? She wants to know if there's a sketch of her in the journal. And she asks, why didn't you allow me a real body? And she's getting real lusty. And the word tafel is a 5'10". As a figure of speech, it means folly or licentiousness or uncontrolled desire. It, as a more literal meaning, it actually is slime. It means slime or untampered mortar, like unrefined material, you know? And so that's also kind of like what these mannequins are. They're unfinished. They're unseasoned. They're tasteless. They're bland. They're blank. They're all of that. But she's got this folly, this uncontrolled desire that messes everything up, actually. So it's definitely folly. I mean, this is the example of what I mean when I say like it's almost as if these episodes are written off of the Gematria code, because they just contain all of the different facets of the meaning of the numbers that go with the episode. It's so weird. She gets pretty biblical. She starts talking about how, you know, she's been with him for eternity and she knows the beginning and the end of time and yada, yada. And then her cartoon body, which is just a head, then it merges with the head of a mannequin. That's it. There's your resh. It's a resh is the countenance, the head or the face. It's the beginning. It's the commencement. It's wisdom. It's all of that. And there she is. She's the goddess of in the beginning God created. You know, her and Renslayer really are. The Genesis 1:1 in Hebrew, it starts with Barashit Elohim, which means not in the beginning. It means by wisdom, Barashit Elohim, Alayim, goddesses created. So these are Renslayer and Miss Minutes are the goddesses that in the beginning created. And what did they create? They created Adam, which is Kronos, the son of heaven and earth. It's totally that. But then he disables her because she's cray, super crazy, too much. He puts her down, got to put her down. Okay, then Renslayer appears on the scene and her opening line is,
it's lovers? Definitely an Ulysses type.
I'm lost you there. You muted too soon. Okay. Well, Renslayer bursts into the scene and she's her opening line is lovers tiff. And a tiff is a fight. You need a weapon to fight. She shows up with a weapon. And on the lovers card is the letter Zion, which means weapon. He shows up and says lovers while holding a Zion, a weapon. I mean, come on, that's it. You know, wow. Like, come on.
Nice.
But I also think back to me connecting her to me connecting her to Thetis, who is a creator of the cosmos figure. That's also, you're right, I think, about her switching to like the universe card, because she shows up with the baton that's on the universe card. She totally does.
Yes. Also, the fact that the magician's table is in this room, that in fact, it's an entire room full of magi tables, and the magi table has all of his elemental tools: a wand, a sword, a cup, and a coin. And so, this entire room is yet again another territory that is inundated with inanimate objects that seem to move anyways, that seem to have wills of their own anyways. And so all of these are the accoutrements of the Southern Hemisphere constellations. It's just riddled with dead objects, riding crops, telescopes, microscopes. So I have a strong case that we are on the rim of Sigma Octantis, where the Indus constellation is surrounded by all of his tools and implements, the telescope, the microscope, and the entire shape of this room is hailing back to my discoveries on the Enneagram and the Ara Altair constellation. That particular shape of the corner of the altar is very much signified by this room at large.
Yeah, it is. It does have that odd trapezoid shape to it. Didn't think about that. Okay, so she comes in and she says, "I'm the one in charge now." And she means business. She vaporizes a mannequin. And, well, what do you know? There's a word that means to take charge or to take over that's a 510. It's just an alternate rearranging of the letters that spell Resh. It's Yod, Resh, Shin. There it is. Like Yarsh, Yarash. To take over, to take charge. Are you guys seeing how virtually every word that could correlate to the numbers I picked out for this episode are present in the episode? If you go to a Hebrew gematria correspondence and just look up 510 and look up 200, I've got most of the words worked into here, and they fit. It's so weird. And also remember, there's other words you could go back to previous words that I've brought up in this episode and they would apply here, like the one of to burn. There's a word that's part of the numbers I picked that is to burn something. And here she is, she's burning up the mannequin. So there, I couldn't even really do full justice to how complex the weave of this gematria program is throughout this episode. It's crazy.
It is crazy, but you know what, Chance? I think it's important that we bring these artifacts together, at least in a as narrow of a location where they can be organized. Our thoughts can be organized, because the mannequin in Latin, the word mannequin is a muñeca. A muñeca is a mannequin. It's a pet name for your sweetheart, you know. Yeah, muñeca, vamos aquí. Well, it's also Monica. And Monica, right away, for me, draws Monica Lewinsky back from the archives of time, because Monica Lewinsky was a famous catfight where an ice skater, a dancing ballerina on the ice, got in a battle and duked it out with another lady, with another woman, fighting over the Olympics. The mannequin even is like presaging a catfight, an epic catfight that's about to break out. So it, in a strange way, it consummates the Monica Lewinsky debacle, because here we are in this leap year, we're going into another Olympic time frame. And I think they're presaging some events in the Olympics, probably. Dude, this is totally written by AI. The fact that they're drawing on multiple languaged puns, that the muñeca is the Monica, this is totally written by AI. And it's designed to have latent triggers in multiple languages.
I want to make some shout outs. I see Priscilla became a member to the channel. Thank you, Priscilla. We will have another Inner World members only episode this week. I just had to get this done first, but we will do it. Also, I see Jason, aka Asajin. He has super chatted. Appreciate you, man. He's also a Patreon subscriber, so support and extra. Love that. Over on the Rockfin side, I got some nice super chats from Ariel and Jason, another Jason. Thank you, guys. Y'all are awesome. Oh, wow. There's some good commentary in the Rockfin side. Very cool. Just want to give my thanks to everybody that's supporting the channel. Makes it a lot easier to do this stuff. Now, we're getting there. We're almost to the end, which is great. I really like this part because it's like the whole culmination. The heroes show up and they're like, Renslayer, what are you doing? Loki's kind of playing a passive role in this section of the episode, but Mobius is asking, is this the free will you were looking for? And this is where she's like, you don't understand the Resh, the crown, the leadership, being the head, the wise one in charge. You have no idea what it takes to lead, to act, to keep order. She says, all that matters is order versus chaos, and I'm order. So this is a fun time to talk about that. What is the cosmos really? You know, we're told by science, the science trademark, that the universe is just this entropy machine that's eventually going to fizzle out into a, you know, from a big bang to a pathetic whimper, where all the heat is distributed evenly and nothing really has any motion or form anymore. But it leaves out the intrinsic order in the cosmos. And in fact, that's what the word cosmos means. It refers to order and that which is adorned, decorated, artistically created and crafted. And in fact, cosmos is a 600. That's a kappa, omicron, sigma, mu, omicron, sigma. 20 plus 70 plus 200 plus 40 plus 70 plus 200. Cosmos is... Oh, well, I also think that order sounds like ardor, which means ardor is a word for love. So divine love is the force that brings order. She's definitely got tough love here. She loves Victor Timely, but she's getting tough on him. I'm in charge now. Cosmos has the same meaning, though, as mundi, the Latin word for world. It's a word that is about beauty and order and adornment. And interestingly enough, the Ethiopian African word Adama means exactly the same thing as cosmos and mundi. So there's another feather in the cap for the idea that I personally am entertaining pretty strongly, that the original system was that Adam was the whole world. That's the Adam Kadmon, the archetypal man, the first man, was the entire world itself. But then the real chaos arrives, which is Sylvie. She just bursts in, explodes everything with the green color of the heart, which is important because the heart is, we find, like, she seems like she's just pure chaos, but we realize she's completely driven by heart. She's all heart. And why we are aware of that is because as she comes to pass judgment on Victor Timely, who says, I haven't done anything. And she says, you'll do terrible things. She's about to shank him. But at that point, he's like, that isn't me. You don't know me. You don't know the heart I have beating in my chest. So amazingly, the 216 shows up again in the word Aria, which is lion. Similar to Ariel, actually, who just super chatted. Thanks for that. But Leo is the sign in which the sun is exalted. And it's also the sign of the zodiac that represents the heart. It's also Rio. If you do the LR swap, which is a river. In fact, Ari is a word that can mean river. Think back to Bacchus and the German word Bach, which is a river or a stream. Victor's also clearly got, like, his hair is his main feature. You know, he's a main character. That's a very Leo trait. But this word Nikayan is a 216, and it means purity or innocence or cleanliness. So she sees him and realizes his innocence, which gives us the 216. And also want to point out that divine love or wisdom, which is the ordering force, order, ardor, according to Godfrey Higgins, was symbolized by the wearing of the heart symbol, which is big. I got to do more digging into that, like the ancient use of the heart symbol or the heart that's with Jesus, you know, in the Sacred Heart of Jesus in a lot of Catholic stuff. But it's basically the idea is that divine wisdom or divine love, same thing, created and ordered the cosmos. But one thing I also was like thinking about this whole episode is that this is a connection that's like a big far east to west reach, is that in the I Ching, 25, the hexagram 25 is innocence, but it also can mean sacrifice. Depending on who's translating from Chinese, it can mean innocence or sacrifice, which is kind of crazy. You know, like this is the I Ching deck that I use, and it's got the third eye of the divine child. the Aries, the Ram, the Lamb, the innocent one coming out of the third eye, the Lotus. It's not all the symbolism of what I'm talking about. But the fact that it's 25 is what is the most interesting sync, because that's the same as the 205 of Aries in Hebrew, which is Resh plus Hey. If you just drop the zero, you get 25. Innocence in the I Ching, the sun in Aries, the innocent part of the year, the pure lamb of God, the newborn baby, all of that. And to top it off, the two settings of this episode temporally, 1868, when Victor was an innocent child, to 1893, is a difference of 25 years. But wait, there's even more. You know, if we're thinking about 25s, the 25th prime number is 97. And that 97, it gives you the word for speech in Hebrew. 97 gives you the word for time in Hebrew. And oddly enough, pertaining to the speech of Victor Timely, he has a stutter. The Hebrew word for stutter is like Lamed, Gimel, Mem, Gimel, Mem. So I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. It'd be like Laga Megamam. But if you take the values of that, 30 times 3 times 40 times 3 times 40, the word for stutter, he has a stutter, you get 432,000, which is the length of the Kali Yuga. It's 720 cycles of 600, then 720 Neros. It's the Kali Yuga. There's all kinds of weird things when you start playing around with the numbers that I enjoyed. But I especially was like, whoa, he's innocent. Wow, she realizes he's innocent. Wow. The whole episode theme is about his innocence. And there's all these 25 things going on. Yeah, I thought it was huge. Huge.
So much, so much. Yes. So 25 is 5 times 5. The magical square for Mars, the 5x5 magical square, yields a 25. Very correspondent to the Aries and the declaration of war, marching into war, getting the marching orders. But the first thing that dies in war, the first sacrifice, is innocence. And so everything we just laid out, wow, nice, has a thread of and also, speaking of rivers that are incendiary or invoke the passions or the manias, the frenzies, that is the river Styx that Achilles is standing on when he gets his hair pulled by Athena and he goes into a hyperdimensional reality outside of time and space that is the universe card. But I want to also incorporate when Ravonna, when she's holding the gun and she thinks that she has everybody under her thumb, she says, "Is that clear?" And everybody's like, "Oh yeah, that's clear." Well, clear is Scientology speak for, have you evacuated your soul and are you ready for somebody else to take control of your will? Have you emptied the Council of Sovereigns out of your faculties so somebody else can take control? So when she says, are we clear? And everybody's got their hands in the air. They're like, yeah, I'm your puppet. Tell me what to do next. And it turns out she was wrong. They were not clear. Because now Sylvie comes in the room and she blows everybody to hell. And then things are clear. It's not clear when you're just using words and empty threats. It's clear once the explosion has actually taken place and you know who's holding the power. Chance, can you go back to the picture of the room exploding? Because the color of Sylvie's power is evoking the dynamics of this card. Even the little sparkly, twinkly, see how it's kind of glittered out? The room is all glittered out. That is so correspondent to this card right here. It's beautiful. And so who holds the power is not clear because you're standing there with a gun. Who holds the power is clear because the room is fucking leveled. And now we know who's got the real power here. And then can you pull up the last graphic I sent you in the Telegram? This kind of summarizes conflict between the three forms of the divine feminine. We have three men and we have three females. There's a 33 going on in this room. If you count Miss Minutes as gender oriented at all, she's really a Baphomet.
Well, there's six, which is spelled shin shin, and shins are like a sideways three.
Nice.
And equals 600.
So this next graphic. Yep. So this next graphic, kind of, you can see how I'm looking at the angle of the roof. It's actually a different, it's a different corner of the R Altair constellation, but you get the gist of it. And the R Altair is sometimes depicted as an oven or a furnace that is maybe has some mechanics, some animation to it, because it's generating smoke that can be captured and harnessed for steam power. So the inanimate objects in motion of Miss Minutes embodying the dummy, the mannequin, becoming the muñeca, the little doll. So yeah, the fact that he has all these love interests kind of coming at him at the same time, it's almost like it's kind of what happens to young, attractive adolescents when they have too many love interests at once. And they schedule two or three dates on the same night, and all the love interests have a conflagration of sorts. Not that that's ever happened to me at all, but that does seem to be what's going on here. And I love the fact that, remember in the universe card, we have the telescopium and the microscopium, which is the symbol of the military industrial complex. So the fact that there's a power struggle over who has command over this archetypal workstation is very profound, because whoever controls the MIC is holding the executive axe. And so, yeah, there's a lot of lusty vying for control, all intrinsic to this scene right here. And then, innocence. I want to put some Twilight spin on the phrase, in war, the first sacrifice is innocence. I want to echo this in a different light, that in war, the first skill that you're going to need in war is nonsense. Nonsense can be very tactically utilized and harnessed to your benefit when you're in a strategically dire situation. Sometimes just putting a little crazy on things turns the tables to your benefit. Just put it that way. Sometimes it's a competition who has the most nonsense of N-O sense.
I like where you're going with that. I also like the comment from Sky in the chat, inner sense, innocence. I think that's sort of the idea that's being put forth in the I Ching version of everything. And there's just so many more like ways I could prove gematria points, but I think I've beaten the horse pretty well, and we'll just kind of move towards the wrap up here. So, wrong screen to share. Come on back. All right. So, you know, he proves his innocence through his heart. And then we get Renslayer showing up, getting up, and Timely gets away. Renslayer is now ready to fight with Sylvie. Sylvie's like, oh, I don't need revenge from you. I've already killed you in my mind thousands of times. And there is a biblical Hebrew word about revenge or exacting vengeance or exacting attacks. That's part of the weave here, but she gets kicked through the door. Sylvie loves to kick people backwards through doors so they land on their ass somewhere unexpected, turning people into fools. And she winds up at the end of time with her God, where she always wanted to be, with the dead Fisher King. To go back to the first part of this episode to get the Fisher King reference, but it's definitely there, especially the wounded Once and Future King. That's it. Once and Future Kang. And oh wow, he's all decayed. And Miss Minutes is there too, and she realizes, well, it was foolish of him to make an enemy out of someone who knows all his secrets. Secrets is another 5-10 in Hebrew if you spell it the right way. But that's pretty much it. We're gonna wrap it up, bring it home. We finished it around 3 hours and 11 minutes on 3:11. I think that's pretty special.
Heck yeah. Can you go back to the graphic where she lands in the tower, in the realm beyond? Because this version of He Who Shall Remain, he's decayed. He's dead and he's decayed. This is card number Dace. Look closely. She lands right on that triangle, right? She's right on the triangle. And look at the triangle that's hiding out in this card number Dace. Now, what's amazing about this moment, for one, it's always been fellas getting kicked by the ladies through the door. This is the first time that a lady kicks another lady through the door, which is pretty interesting. The kicking through the door is signified. But in this moment, my star card, the dancer, is actually coming in unison to the number Dace. And this is a combination. Look at that scene. You have the fortune card is him decaying with the apple, right? The apple of discord. And then she is the dancer who just landed right in the lap of his high tower. And so this is very profound to me because 2 weeks ago, these cards were not side by side. These cards were divided by an entire Enneagram station. And for the leap year, I have ceremoniously brought them together. And it is signifying this event right here in the series. It is so profound what this is telling me, Chance. There is consistency to my Enneagram that has been going on all along. And so, yeah, for her to be thrown into this position at the very end, at the pinnacle of this episode, is quite profound. Can you pull up the last graphic I sent you? I'm totally heading for the end, for the finish line, I promise.
Oh, yeah, we're good. I'm having fun. We're all having fun here.
But this next... Awesome. This next graphic is kind of corresponding
your favorite,
to the
fact Tulsi Gabbard. You have a crush on her.
Well, you're so right, dude. It's so shameless and obvious. Dude, they got me when I was young when they sent Wonder Woman through my heavens. I can't look away. She's totally Wonder Woman. It's amazing. So Cryptonesia, there it is, bro. There it is. So the firing off of the Battle of Troy, the story of the Iliad, is kicked off by this golden apple of discord rolled into the room that, and it has the phrase for the fairest or for the finest. And then the three goddesses get in a fight over who this is intended for. And so the apple is kind of like a hand grenade because it explodes with all discord and dis-ease. And I see these three ladies on the world stage being put in a position to kick off another Iliad, another fight over who's going to have control of the story going forward in the future. But part of the reason why this has a lot of the artifacts is because the Olympics is taking place in Paris. And Paris was the name of the judge who had to choose between Hera, Artemis, and Athena. And they had to duke it out over this apple of discord. And so I just see them recreating the epics ceremoniously right in time for the word Paris to kick off another conflagration of really significant and potentially ritualistic global proportions. It's really profound. So, yeah, I just wanted to share this one.
Because that's really good because
they just got it. They can't resist.
Well, the apple of discord being the metaphor of who is the fairest of them all, right? Snow White and the poison apple. The Hera, Aphrodite, and Athena getting in a fight over who is going to be chosen as the most fair. And isn't that what goes on here? It's like it's Miss Minutes, it's Renslayer, and it's Sylvie. And Sylvie's going to just kill him because she's the third choice. You know, and he's kind of oscillating between the other two to decide who it is, but it's kind of true. And in fact, this is the genesis of theoretically the multiversal war, which is like the, you know, the macrocosmic fall of Troy that, or battle for Troy that the apple of discord incites. And then here he is, he's still got the apple at the end of the line, the end of the timeline, you know, Paris. That apple kills him. Paris does not survive the whole ordeal. Interesting. I like that weave a lot. Like that a lot.
Totally. Yeah, man. And then can you pull up the most recent? Just one more little image, because I did not know this until this project. But Terpsichore, this is the muse, Terpsichore. This is the muse of dance. And she is holding the triangle. And this is not just any triangle. Now, musically, I'm missing a lot of context. But just grasping at straws, this to me is a samba triangle. This triangle is an instrument of the Brazilian samba music. And that is so profound because I've already discovered many capoeira instruments and Brazilian artifacts in the tarot card. But for the dancing muse to be correspondent to the triangle, it really brings these two cards together, because this was Terpsichore already. And this was more of a Athena, the goddess of wisdom. But now I'm seeing that I was supposed to fuse them together. And in fact, Tulsi Gabbard's name is just a few letters off from Terpsichore. And so I'm putting all my money on Tulsi Gabbard is going to win because everybody else is ridiculous. But I think ultimately the message, the subconscious message that I think we could benefit from is movement. Movement es da vida. Movement will be life. And the only way that they know that you're alive, the textbooks still prove this out. The proof that you're alive is if they poke you with a stick and you move. That is the scientific test for if you're alive. Guess what just happened? A bunch of people got poked with sticks and came back for more. They asked to be poked again. And so movement es da vida is the essence of the muse of dance. And I'm taking this advice very personal. I'm going to kick back into my dancing. I'm going to dust off my capoeira boots for sure for the next 30 years. Can dance my way all the way to the pearly gates, baby. So yeah, I just love knowing that Terpsichore has been signified by the sacred triangle that is an artifact of the samba music from Brazil. That's beautiful. I love it.
You know, Terpsichore is the mother of the sirens. Did you know?
Yes, that is weird too.
And
weird too.
There's a lot more sirens and, like, you know, surprise, not sudden the, need for the ambulance after the whole movement, living or dead test, big time.
Nice. Good call. Dang, that's wild. That's so wild. These muses are doing fine, man. They're doing fine. They are calling shots on high levels of thought.
Well, I think they're just a version of the Ennead, you know. It's all the same group. Don't listen to the sirens, Gabe. Zerlath recommends. All right, I think we're ready to
crazy.
I think we're ready to bounce. You got any final thoughts, buddy?
Well, yeah, I would say the Muses may be the Enneagram or the Ennead, but there's some of the most far out philosophers of modern time are now dabbling with the concept that numbers are alive. Numbers are alive. And that is really nuts. Yeah, whatever that is something to make me turn and run the other way. But I think that when JFK went to Germany and mispronounced the phrase, "Ich bin ein Berliner," he said it wrong. And then history went back and everybody repeats his mistake, his faux pas, as though like it's almost like a strange ego trip to say, oh, the president got it wrong, so I'm going to correct him, therefore I'm better than the president. There's a mental snare to correcting the president. Well, the thing that he said wrong actually translates to I am a number. Ich bin ein Number. I'm just a number. And everybody walked right into that trap. And everybody went along and they're like, oh yeah, I am a number. I am a number. I think they were correcting the president, but there's an anagram hiding behind Berliner. Ich bin ein Number. I am a number. I do not comply. I do not associate with numbers, even if they are alive.
Go watch the Pixar movie Soul. All the souls are numbered. It's a very Gnostic Demiurgos thing. There's even like a soul Jew that counts all of the souls as they enter and exit the earth plane. It's far out. I like it though. Okay. So guys, lots of ways to support me and Gabe. Check out the show notes for links of all the things you can do to support me. Appreciate the super chats. We've got a lot of good stuff coming up this week. It's a big week. Life is popping off here in the realm with spring coming. But for sure, send Gabe some super chats too on Cash App, $SlickDissident. That's the best way to do it as far as I know. I appreciate all the stuff you guys sent my way. Much love, you guys. Thanks, Priscilla, for becoming a YouTube member. Good times. Love you all. Catch you on the next one. Don't know when we'll get to the next Loki episode, but you know, by the time we will, I'm sure everyone will be hungry for it. It's going to be fun. Good night. Love y'all.
Love and respect, y'all.